Hello, everyone, and welcome to Between the Sheets, episode 18. And tonight we'll be discussing November 17th through the 23rd, 1991. And it's going to be a good show tonight because we have a really good guest who we'll get to in a second. But first off, I'll introduce my co-host first, the Keith Olbermann of Wrestling Media, David Bixen's fan. Bix, how you doing?
I am doing well. I think we have a very good show today. If just because I know we're going
to punch Bix that badly?
I mean that as he wants to bounce around from job to job. He's worked for every wrestling news site just about that's in existence.
No. I'm the Minoru Suzuki of professional wrestling media.
He's bringing back Online Onslaught any day now.
Yes. He's going to be working as Mr. Tito.
Actually, wait. I think that still may exist, by the way.
Really? I haven't even thought to check it.
I think it did. It still did for, like, after I ever stopped. Okay, I have to look. Yeah.
But anyway.
Yeah, I'm doing well. I think we've got a good show today. We got a good guest. I know we're going to probably talk pretty in depth about one of my all-time favorite matches. So.
Oh, definitely. This week was unnatural to pick because of that match. And the guest is kind of unnatural, too, because in this time period, if I'm not mistaken, he was on the internet. One of the early internet wrestling fans at Bradley.
Rex Pro Wrestling, holla.
Yes, right. RSPW in the early days. And,
yeah, seriously.
And one of the players at the Death Valley Driver message board. Very funny. Some of the best stuff in the reviews that was around, just great stuff, and always great in the chat room. Whenever we watch Raw, this man would always crack us up, and that's Pete Stein.
Pogo Pete Stein.
Pete, how you doing, man?
Oh, you guys flatter me. Good to be here tonight. Good to be on. I love the show. It's been doing that between that and the Exile. It's just been a lot, just a gold mine of great stuff. Great podcast from you guys.
Thanks a lot. And I'll have a thing on the next Exile at later on in the show when we do our plug section. So be on the listen out for that. But yeah, as I said, 1991 seemed like a natural deal for you to be on the show since you were, like I said, online at the time. You're doing RSPW. In fact, I don't know if you were doing it at this time period, but you were doing Lucha stuff on there, right?
The Lucha stuff, kind of the really in-depth reviews came on later. That was like around 96, I think. Early Lucha stuff, that was Dave Fields.
That's right.
Yep, Dave Fields. He would do the weekly CMLL, and which was just a total blast to watch at that time. I was at Bradley. Just kind of in a bit of a vacuum. It was kind of in like a down period. Didn't get a whole lot. Basically, the only TV we got out there, I think we got the Cindies, and then we got whatever was on cable. But no Lucha, no nothing. I get the feeling, it's interesting, because being out there, if you'd been out there a few years earlier, like if I'd been in their early 80s, you would have had AWA, you would have had Bruiser, I think they had Memphis on at some point. So it's kind of like between walls, I guess, in the product-wise, really, on a national level when I was out there. But yeah. Which was why RSPW was such a blast, because it was really like a revelation. It was, yeah, hey, I'm not the only dork out there who likes this stuff.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And as we start our show with the World Wrestling Federation, they had we're going to start with a TV show, actually a syndicated TV show, as Pete mentioned, that was taped not real far away from Bradley, I guess, Fort Wayne, Indiana, yeah. On October 21st. The show aired on November 23rd, so I'm a full month between taping. But yeah, a couple big things happened on this show that was really important for WWF. Ric Flair introduced Mr. Perfect as his new executive consultant, replacing Bobby Heenan as manager. And more importantly, after a squash match where Jake the Snake Roberts went over Bob Werner in 42 seconds with a DDT, he got on the microphone and goaded Randy Savage, who was doing commentary, into the ring, where he trapped him in the ring ropes, assaulted him, and allowed his King Cobra Snake to gnaw on Savage's arm. Roberts held officials at bay until Savage, who was delirious, was able to get pulled out of the ring. Miss Elizabeth and Roddy Piper came out trying to assist Savage during the segment. Now, to help sell the snake bite angle, they pulled Savage from the dates on November 23rd in Tampa and November 24th in Miami, and replaced him with Sergeant Slaughter. Although Savage worked the Orlando show on November 22nd. In other words, where they originally false advertised Sid Justice in the main event after he was injured and replaced him with Savage, they were actually also false advertising Savage since they pulled him because of an angle they had produced nearly 5 weeks earlier. So classic, you know, this type of era stuff with injury angles. But Pete, this was a very controversial angle in the time period in WWF. They never did anything like this. And it got over pretty big. And Jake Roberts in this time period was just an amazing performer.
God, he was just, he was like the devil, basically. He was like Satan personified at that point, especially by their standards. And I have to ask, I mean, you have a, you know, Savage Delirious because he's such, so lucid normally and so normal.
Yeah. He was just, even more delirious.
That just stands out.
Yeah, he was even more delirious. And his acting job in this was great, too. The punch drunk, you know, punching around. And Vince was fantastic selling this as well on commentary. I mean, yeah,
and Piper trying to get him out, too.
Yeah, Piper, you know, being concerned, and Elizabeth crying. Yeah, this whole angle, man, was just, it's so intense and dark for WWF, Bix. You know, you had just been, you know, I would say weeks and months earlier, you know, they're still doing kid-friendly stuff, and here they go in this adult-type direction, which they kind of did, you know, other things like that, too, in this time period that gave the product a different feel.
It was really like kind of a slow burn throughout all of 1991. I mean, we've talked about this before. I think when we had Les Moore on, we talked about it a little bit, that we really don't know why, but they clearly were making a conscious change throughout the year. I mean, whether it's at the Royal Rumble earlier in the year, where
maybe just like testing the waters, trying to
where Sherry's kind of threatening, offering to Service Warrior to get Savage a title shot at the Rumble.
Yes.
Oh, then later, so many bad visuals of Warrior getting pleasured. It's just horrible.
Undertaker putting Warrior in the casket, and it's treated like completely seriously, like that. It's like not. It's, oh, we put him in the casket, but then you're like, oh wait, that's an airtight casket.
Yeah.
And then it's like they're trying to get.
He's gonna suffocate.
Right. And then it just kind of went slowly from there. I mean, the Jake Warrior stuff was kind of. I mean, it was. I think they had the same edge in mind, but it was a little weird. I mean. You kind of get what I'm saying. But in general, they were just kind of inching towards that. And this was really when it got over the top. And also, they did more heavy heat angles in general than they had been doing. Like when Flair came out for his Superstars debut and had the thing with Piper. And Piper accidentally lays Vince out with the chair. So this all kind of led up to...
And even when Flair had his debut, I think he debuted against Jim Powers, right?
Yeah.
And they just kind of, and he just kind of like goes through him in like 20 seconds, and I'm like, okay, that's it. Now what do you got? And it's just like they didn't usually bring guys in, especially.
I don't think the match ever happens though, does it? In that angle.
I don't even remember. It's been a long, long time.
But anyway,
he beats him up. I think though he may not have a match.
But But anyway, so with this. I mean, also, I mean, depending on the market, it varied whether or not you had the big red X or not. Mm-hmm. Like, or was it actually, did it depend on the market, or was it just syndication versus cable? I'm trying to remember. Chris, do you remember, like, where it was added and where it wasn't?
I remember when they did the Beefcake Ron Bass thing with the Spurs. That was in New York, that was syndication, and they had the X out for that.
I think I think they had the X for Ron Bass and Bruce Beefcake. They had the X everywhere except for, like, one of the Canadian recap shows. That was weird.
I vaguely remember the Red X. Yeah. So it did do its syndication, yeah.
Okay. But I know I saw it without the X before they put out the Jake DVD, though.
And it's just funny because it's like just this big giant. It's not like they're digitizing or just like blocking out one part. It's just one big giant red X, like the Stars and Bars flag. And
yeah,
it's like,
people have never seen the big red X.
Well, USA actually aired it uncensored.
Right, that's what I was asking.
Yeah, yeah, they aired it uncensored, but on syndication, that's where it was X'd out.
Right.
Okay.
So you had to watch it on cable too.
Right. And the big red X went back to what? The first one? I mean, I know at least the early '80s because they used it for Snuka and Ray Stevens, but I think it went back further than that, right?
Bruno Larry? Did that have the red X? It had something.
On the commercial, I remember I watched the commercial tape, the first WWF videotape, they had that, and that wasn't censored. They had that as is.
I know, but I think there was something before Ray Stevens and Snuka. Snuka and Stevens is the earliest one that I know for sure had it.
But I think Bruno and Larry had that too. I want to say that.
Because they did blood so rarely on TV that it's hard just trying to like crack your brain and try to remember the times where they actually did bust it out.
Exactly.
But that was one of those unique WWF things that they wouldn't blur stuff, they wouldn't digitize stuff, as we'll talk about later.
Yeah.
But they would use the big red X, where it was just a big red X, and it also said censored.
Was it Mid-Atlantic where they do like the solarized thing? Yeah, that was great. They needed to do that more often. Someone else.
Yeah, the Wahoo
Abbey.
Yeah, definitely. They went that they would use that to start their matches off with that little solarized deal, and they use it for that angle to cover up the blood. But yeah, like I said, that Jake Savage angle was a huge deal, and as we mentioned the previous time we did 1991, Savage was taking the spot of Ultimate Warrior in this whole deal anyway. So it was supposed to be Jake and Warrior was the angle, and once Warrior did what he did at SummerSlam, then Savage took his spot. But
now was Savage had been reinstated in the storyline by this point, right?
Elizabeth was begging for his reinstatement.
Oh, she was still begging for him to be reinstated.
Yeah, on the show, yeah. So this is – and he gets reinstated after because he gets reinstated at Tuesday in Texas, if I'm not mistaken.
I thought he was reinstated – didn't he work Survivor Series and get disqualified?
I don't remember that.
I thought maybe not.
No, yeah, he was supposed to be, but he didn't.
Okay.
But yeah, because Jake didn't work it either, if I'm not mistaken.
Okay, yeah, that's right.
So, but anyway, the other part of the show, the Flair Perfect deal, Bobby Heenan asked off, and which we know the story later on in the Torch, it said he asked off for personal reasons, and of course, Flair talks about later on his podcast and stuff that Heenan asked off because he couldn't handle the party of Ric Flair's life.
Yeah, he just talk about a losing battle, Jesus.
He couldn't do it. And Mr. Perfect, who's not able to wrestle because of his injuries and stuff like that, got into the role. And the Flair Perfect Heenan, so just triumvirate.
Some people just value their livers more than others.
Oh, totally. Flair Perfect and Heenan was a great triumvirate together. Just fantastic.
It's like you see that photo. It's like that you see that photo that's circulating of Dusty Rhodes, Ray Stevens, and Nick Bockwick on the AWA heel bus, you're like just like to be a fly on the wall of that bus, and just the sheer alcohol content that must be floating around in there.
Yeah, exactly.
Like a booze cruise kind of thing.
Yeah, but you look at the Royal Rumble '92, and they were together for that great promo. I mean, it worked out so well. If you're not gonna have Heenan there. Heenan can do his job on commentary, being the manager, but Perfect being at ringside and just the stuff they did through 92. This was a great marriage, I thought.
Now, question for you guys. Did you ever feel like they maybe tried too hard to have – did Flair necessarily need someone else after Heenan already introduced him? Since it's not like he needed a manager to talk for him. Or do you think he just needed WWF person with him to?
I don't think he needed it.
Clearly, he valued. I'm guessing he just he probably just valued a Hendricks business acumen as a manager.
Yeah, definitely. But I don't think he didn't need it. But I think it was a good compliment because. I mean, Henning wasn't a manager. He was just a second, per se. Because Flair did most of the talking, and Henning would just get his lines in. It wasn't like JJ or anything like that. I mean, Henning was just there. I mean, he was just there as a friend.
But it's like you look back at early days when you had Grand Wizard managing, talking for Slaughter. It's just like, why would from watching as a fan, why would you need anybody to talk for Slaughter? And yet there you were. You had the Wiz doing his promos for him.
Yeah, and it was a deal where WWF, if you were a heel, you pretty much had to be managed by somebody.
Right.
I mean, that's just the way it was.
But even so, that just stood out.
Yeah, very few ever in that era were not managed by somebody. Jake's one of them. You know, right. I mean, it just didn't happen. And so even Ric Flair had to have somebody with him.
Yeah.
You know, I guess you could kind of say it was like Savage and Elizabeth in a heel way, but hitting them or talking.
They had a very specific, it was just the rhythm they had. It was just, there's a certain flow they needed for everything. It was just their way of doing stuff.
Yeah, he was Heenan's, concierge, in the whole deal.
Yeah, exactly. Perfect.
So, and that's just the way it was. And speaking of Flair, on November 20th in the Charlotte, North Carolina courtroom, the WWF claims have contacted all the top 30 market stations and asked them to digitize or somehow obstruct televising the NWA World Heavyweight Title belt during the Ric Flair Undertaker attacking Hulk Hogan angle on the funeral parlor on the WWF syndicated shows that aired on November 23rd and November 24th. The week before, there was a legal agreement between the NWA and WWF where the belt wouldn't air in syndication on November 16th and 17th, but the belt was in full camera view in the top 30 markets anyway. The NWA legal counsel didn't dispute that the WWF made the best effort possible to remove the belt from syndication, but they then tried to get a legal injunction for the next weekend, not only for the WWF, but all the TV stations get showing the belt on their shows. The WWF argued against the injunction, saying it would hurt their relations with their various affiliates, and it would make their affiliates believe they had done something wrong when they believe they haven't done anything wrong. After viewing the videos of the situation, the judge denied the NWA's attempt to get an injunction, and he ruled that whatever damages had been done to the NWA was largely due to Ric Flair appearing on the telecast with the belt, not the WWF forcing him to do it. The reasonable facsimile issue wasn't brought up. However, as of this weekend, Flair was out with yet another different belt. This one was an old WWF World Tag Title belt, since the WWF emblem was prominently on this belt, which kind of ruins the gimmick in some ways about it not being a legit championship belt, which looks nothing like the NWA title belt. This case may be over, or the NWA could attempt to sue the WWF for damages. Although in most cases, but not every case, if the restraining order is denied, it is generally considered as not worth to go into trial over. Now, Bix, we just vaguely talked about this earlier. The whole blurring of the belt deal was just so funny to watch because, I mean, sometimes it was, badly done and you could see the belt, and sometimes it was just so horribly done. I mean, it was just so weird to see the whole deal. And then finally, they just gave up. And that's when, it wasn't too long after this, they just quit even trying. They just didn't even do a belt anymore. So it was just great WF ridiculousness. But this whole court deal, boy, the NWA came out looking like morons and this
chumps.
They?
Chumps is what it is.
Well, they won, though.
Well, kind of, but the Ric Flair got the blame. Well, they didn't get the blame.
I mean, but they did get what they wanted, though.
It's one of those things where you win in the technical sense, but really, for all intents and purposes, you bombed this thing.
Exactly. They were trying to go after WWF. That was their deal, but the judge went against them, and Ric Flair was at fault. He did it on his own free will.
Hey, where have we heard that about a Flair this week?
Exactly. Hilarious.
The more things change, the more they change.
Same planet, different worlds.
Exactly.
Of course, the really famous thing about this is that it ended up being precedent. So when WCW had Medusa throw the belt to the garbage because it the whole thing about a promotion's belt being its intellectual property, then that was the beginning of the end for WCW and WWF's lawsuit against them. And that, of course, eventually led to them getting the first right refusal to buy the company and blah, blah, blah. And now we only have one major company. Sorry, TNA.
TNA, who's that?
They're on the TV Guide channel.
Yeah, that's right.
Test and Albert started a wrestling promotion?
If only. that I tell you, Pop TV's TNA.
Yeah, well, Albert has a pretty good wrestling promotion now.
If only, especially with Test being dead and all, yeah.
But have you seen Albert's wrestling promotion? It's pretty good. He has this wrestling cool promotion in Florida.
Yeah, I know. He's doing pretty good for himself.
He brought in Norman Smiley as his co-trainer, Sarah Del Rey.
Kurt is down there, Robbie Brookside,
yeah. Can you imagine the Pop Zone? That's a whole other show. But this is you're right about the legal precedent this whole thing sets. And of course, the belt would end up back in the possession of the NWA, and made its return to television in 1992, blah, 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 blah. But yeah, it was just, this is just an interesting deal. And Flair using a WWF tag title belt. Of all the belts to pick.
Well, okay. No, I know why. I can figure why they did it, because it was the closest in size and shape.
Yeah, but that those tag title belts were distinguishable, Pete. I mean, you knew. I mean, if you watched WWF, you knew what those tag title belts looked like because they had them for so long.
I think it was one of the Madison Square Garden back when they still showed the house shows on MSG.
It was the first Hogan match. I know what you're talking about.
Okay, yeah, where Flair comes out and it's just like, and I'm trying to remember. It's like he's got the belt and they pan back and he's on the Diamond Vision. All of a sudden, they're just like a big thing over the belt to cover it up. It's like, why?
Right, it was just the state. I think it was like a stationary black dot.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. That's exactly.
That they couldn't. They couldn't move it at all. So right. Just when he would move and the belt wouldn't be covered anymore. You would see that it was just a beat up old tag title belt with the WWF logo. They did a good job on the syndicated shows, though.
Yeah, but the garden thing kind of blew it out of the water.
Yes, and was it Flair that had the other belt commissioned, or was it WWF?
I think Flair did.
Okay, so then Flair has the very close
facsimile. It sounds like a kind of thing Flair would do.
Well, and it sounds like from what was in the newsletter that Flair already had the other belt made at this point because there's the reasonable facsimile thing. And mm-hmm. I think that eventually did end up getting argued when Flair tried to use it at like one or two shows and they said, no, you can't do that. And it was never seen again until the skit Flair did before I think it was between the August Clash in 94 and Halloween Havoc, sometime in there.
Yeah, when he was the real world's champion.
Yes, again.
Yeah, I had that poster on my wall, Bradley. I love that thing to death. That Ric Flair WWF poster.
Yeah.
So great.
Yeah, yeah, and yeah, that belt, I mean, it was a good-looking belt, that facsimile belt that he had made up, so.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Probably now, in some kind of plumbing and heating valve company's office right now.
Oh, one of his ex-wives or something like that.
It's in a poker room somewhere.
Yeah.
Collateral.
I don't know if that... Have we ever actually heard that's one of his vices?
Well, who knows? Who knows what Flair... Flair, you know, it wouldn't surprise me to hear anything that Flair did.
No, he could have lost it to someone else and someone else could have played poker and put it up or something. I don't know.
It gets around like
Flair does.
It's like Pedro's WWF belt.
Yeah,
or the Johnny Baron belt that went in someone's attic.
No, it was his wife's attic, though.
Oh yeah, 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 right, right.
Pedro Morales probably pawned his belt because Tom Burke found it in a pawn shop in Queens one day.
That's hideous.
God, that's hilarious. But speaking of pawn. Well, I don't know why I'm making that segue. The Nasty Boys and Legion of Doom.
You know, Peter, I think you threw your back out making that segue. That was quite a stretch.
Yeah. Wow. Nasty Boys and Legion of Doom worked a match on November 21st on the Arsenio Hall show, which is one of our go-to deals on these shows, with Jake the St. Roberts and Gene Oakland doing commentary. The crowd didn't care for this segment, although it reached a large number of people who don't usually watch wrestling. And plugged the pay-per-view, Survivor Series pay-per-view. Most feel the segment wasn't particularly strong because the crowd got into the Nasty Boys more faces than LOD among those who cared. Now, I don't remember this, Bix.
Vaguely
remember it happening. I didn't really see it. I remember it happening, but it's not like I was paying attention to it, but I remember it went down. But I could see the Nasties kind of getting over as faces against the LOD just because they're smaller. Yet the big face painted guys are looking like the big bruisers. I could see the Nasties sort of being like the lesser of two evils there.
Yeah, but God, I mean, and Gene and Jake Roberts is the announcers. I mean, the whole thing is just weird.
That alone makes you want to track this down.
Yeah, I don't think this is on YouTube though, right?
I have never seen it, so. I do know that it was on some of these like tapes of all the wrestlers on talk shows that a certain tape dealer in New York has.
Would this be the same certain tape dealer in New York that also has compilations of every single wrestling music video?
Yes, that same tape dealer.
Okay.
That same guy. But I do remember seeing that in the listing. So that's a cool little deal. And Arsenio, like we talked about before on the show, loved having wrestling people on his show. It happened a lot.
But he was also a bigger WCW fan.
Well, yeah. But, I mean, we're seeing this now, you know, with wrestlers getting more and more talk show appearances. So,
I just punched in Arsenio Hall WWF on YouTube, and you would not believe he had Bad News Brown on.
Yep.
That's just amazing.
He had a lot of people on. I mean, yeah.
Ted and Virgil, yeah, Twin Towers.
Both yeah.
Of course, the Randy Savage one for WrestleMania 5 is the greatest, though.
Yeah.
With Morgan Fairchild.
Yes. Yeah. But, yeah, Arsenio and Conan, you know, has wrestlers on his show, and Fallon, of course, had Undertaker, Brad Maddox on his show. I mean, it's wrestlers and talk shows good together. So there's a natural fit.
There's a hamminess that fits well between the two. There's some synergy.
Oh, yeah, totally.
Well, and, you know? And especially, though, if it's someone like Arsenio, like Regis, who really knows how to play off of them.
Oh, Regis can't be late. Yeah.
Well, Regis was the one who did this stuff in L.A. back in, like, the 50s and 60s, right? So he would have been huge for, like, decades.
Yeah, I mean,
like,
he had Bliss.
Like, Blassie and the Destroyer on or whatever.
Right, and then even before his show was Regis and Kathy Lee, when it was, like, what was it, AM New York? Or whatever.
Yeah.
He had Slaughter on, like in 84. He would have Iron Sheik and Blassie. So he had a lot of people. He knew that wrestlers made good guests, like from the beginning of his television career.
And this week we're talking about Undertaker was on the show in full character, and that is on YouTube. Undertaker and Paul Bearer coming out.
Oh, I remember that one, because that's the one where Regis starts holding up like all the Hogan merchandise and the Hogan wrestling buddies and throwing them at Undertaker.
Yes.
And Taker just sat there and took it. And you're telling me Taker just sat there and took it?
Yes. He was very stoic. In his
obviously
actions.
Not staying in character that much. Got a kayfabe at all.
Yeah, he was so entrenched in character. And Paul Bearer was too. But Paul Bearer was still holding the urn up and, oh, yeah.
Oh, now see, Paul Bearer, I could totally see as a big hit every show. I could see him doing all those shows. Because he was.
Meanwhile. He was really good. Doing that type of stuff.
Especially like when he go in like National Network and he'd be with like George Jones or whomever, just be trying not to lose his shit for George or the other guys because he was a huge country fan.
Yeah, but Kathy Lee, everybody, if you watch this video, watch Kathy Lee during this segment. She had that she did not want any part of this situation at all. But this was too goofy for her. You know, we could have Ultimate Warrior and Hogan and Savage, but the Undertaker in full character and doing his full gimmick. Yeah, it was too goofy for her. So that was funny to watch. I'm sure she's probably...
Looking at the screen grab on YouTube, it's like, well, could it be like he's like a foot and a half over her, just like towering? That could play some factor into it.
Yeah, I mean, she probably...
There was the whole Rick Rude thing, too.
Yeah, and Rick Rude. But
just
yeah.
Clearly just burned out on all of this.
Yeah, I wish Frank Gifford could have had a conversation with Rick Rude. That would have been pretty funny to see. But
what kind of competition?
Knowing some of the things you allegedly heard about Gifford too.
Yeah, exactly. Frank had his deals in the past.
I can't ever think of
deals, Frank, quote unquote.
I can't ever think of Frank Gifford without thinking of the what was it the sting up like that they. That woman did where she slept with him and then released the transcript to the Inquirer or whatever it was. And then on Howard Stern, they had like this old man voiceover actor reading the transcript.
Yeah.
In like the most exaggerated old man voice, just going like over and over. And apparently this is what actually was in the transcript that he just kept saying over and over. You have beautiful breasts.
Christ.
Yeah,
that wasn't even me doing an impression of anyone. It was terrible.
That was a bad look for Frank, but Frank was one of the all time greats. So we'll let him cut him some slack over here. Now on the November 22nd Orlando Arena show, which Savage worked, it was the lowest attended show ever in the market in the its new building, 2,100 fans. And on this show.
The market, because that goes up. That Orlando would go back like decades.
So I guess Orlando for WWF.
Well, in that building.
Oh, okay.
Yeah,
okay.
In the arena.
Sure. So, yeah.
Because the arena had only been, it may have been around since like 88.
88, 89.
You have the Magic, that's where they started playing their game set.
Yep.
And WWF was coming there as, right after they opened. So, yeah.
Just a syntax issue there. It's like.
Yeah, the.
What?
yeah, the attendance is low there. But Skinner, Steve Kern, pinned Jimmy Richland, or as Dave says, Jimmy Backlund. Guess you can't use that last name on a Titan show. In a match where Richland juiced hard way by reopening a cut from the night before from an indie match with Pat Tanaka. And the agents weren't too happy about juice in the prelim match. And he was scheduled to work a few more dates, but he was replaced by Hurricane Walker.
I don't even know who that is.
Yeah. Hurricane Walker was another Steve Kern guy from PWF.
What was the rest of the card like on that, just for such a small crowd?
I'll go look.
I'm sorry, I'm not trying to.
You go look real quick. Jimmy Del Rey, he had a pretty long career before he became a heavenly body. Jimmy Backlund and other various gimmicks, but I mean, he worked in FMW. He was a light heavyweight champion.
He was on the first FMW show.
Yeah.
He did Wing, I think, too, at some point.
Yeah, Wing.
I think he's our junior champion.
But yeah, he's a guy that just bounced around and was a really good, solid jobber on television whenever they go to Florida. And he's a guy that doesn't get nearly enough, talk about him, because he was, I mean, he replaced Stan Lane in Heavenly Bodies, but he was
There's talk about him. It's just not the right kind of talk.
Well, yes.
Yeah. That story comes up every week, either with him or Tatanka, it seems like.
Yeah. And there's also
looking like the sleaziest dude on the planet. And think how much ground that covers in wrestling.
Yeah, he was pretty sleazy, and he loved to play the jokes, especially burning people's hats on fire and stuff like that.
People, you mean Marty Gorman.
Yes. But
okay, I have the results.
All right.
Okay, so 2,100 people, lowest attendance to that point at the venue. Chris Chavis defeated Kato. The Beverly Brothers defeated the Rockers after Michaels accidentally reversed a pin attempt, causing Jannetty to be pinned.
That around the horn when they returned.
Skinner defeated Jimmy Richland. Randy Savage subbing for Sid Justice pinned Jake Roberts. The Berserker pinned Conan Chris Walker, who we'll be talking about later. The Undertaker pinned Hacksaw Jim Duggan, and the Legion of Doom defeated the Natural Disasters by DQ, so the attendance does not really surprise me there. A lot of stuff going on that day. They also had the Arsenio taping. So
Legion of Doom worked Orlando, and they worked the Arsenio taping?
Yeah, wait a second. Aired that. It must have aired that night. Graham has. So
yeah, they worked on the 21st.
And they also had a Richfield, Ohio show, which had Skinner over Colonel Mustafa.
Wait, Skinner was on both shows?
No, I'm sorry, Tito. I don't know how I screwed that one up. Davey Boy over Barbarian, Warlord over Valentine, Money Inc., who I don't think were officially Money Inc. yet, over Bossman and Virgil. Nasty Boys over Bushwhackers, Brett over Mountie, and Hogan over Flair. That drew 10,000 in Richfield, Ohio, so good crowd there.
Yep, B-show.
Mm-hmm. And, yeah, I think that was it. I thought I saw another one, but that was it. And then the Sun Dome the next night with the same crew but some different matches. Drew 2,500. So not a good swing for that crew. The main event on that one was Duggan and Slaughter, with Slaughter subbing for Savage over Jake and Undertaker, because by that point the angle it aired locally, I guess.
Yeah, that's why they couldn't do it. No, that's why I was talking about earlier. He could work that Friday show, but he couldn't work the Saturday show. Yeah, you know? And he's on television.
Semantics.
Yeah. Now back.
Oh my God! I got it. One more. Just to the rest of this Florida swing. Palm, a matinee in West Palm Beach on the 24th. 1,500 people.
Yeah, Florida had issues in that time period. I think they were just getting burnt out on wrestling, because they had some really bad houses. Both promotions did in this era, Florida.
And no attendance for Miami on the 24th, which it says included Jim Duggan and Jim Neidhart, which would be the evening show on that day.
And that was really all down to like CWF and all the other post show, just like burning out the whole territory, the whole state, basically. Lull for the business, or?
Yeah, I would think that would be more of what it was. There's just a lull in the business in that time period.
Well, and the promoter died tragically from mental illness, and then Michael Hayes went on TV and said he was weak for killing himself. And
yeah, but Florida was running. I mean, that, yeah, but they were.
I just honestly, I just wanted to throw in a reference to that angle this week. No particular reason.
Yeah, but yeah, I understand why you were doing that. But yeah, I mean that. there were successful shows in Florida well after that. But yeah,
I mean, they 86 was the absolute.
But then you get down towards like the end, you get like 87, 80, 89, and it's just like it's on fumes. And then Dusty tries the restart, and that doesn't really go anywhere. It's just like a continue. It's just like a continuation of that.
Well, they ran pay per views. I mean, they ran the Royal Rumble was in Florida two straight years.
True.
It was in Orlando and Miami, in 1991. So, I mean, they went there. I mean, Fred Raven had big shows. WCW had pay-per-views in Florida. So, I don't know. I guess maybe
that was also – but that was also a different industry back when. They were only doing, like, maybe three or four pay-per-views a year to begin with. So, it wasn't, like, watered down yet.
Yeah. Yeah, and it's pay-per-view against house show, too.
Right. Mm.
So, that could have been what it is as well. Now, back to that 11-23 episode of Superstars. It was Big Dooley Busick's last TV match. And he lost to Bret Hart in an Intercontinental title match, a rare title match on television, as he decided to quit the promotion after being tired of the low pay and doing jobs on TV constantly. The theory was that his push died the day Sid Justice started having heat with The Office, since Busick was basically brought in to appease Sid. In that watch, Steve Beverly wrote that he was expected to rejoin Global, quote-unquote, and that WWF has not settled on a replacement, quote-unquote.
I put that there because, okay, A, well... Global didn't take it back. B, nope. A replacement? But did they really need to designate a replacement for Big Bully Busick?
I think as like somebody to be managed by Harvey Whippleman.
Okay, well, like, which they didn't do. Yeah, Sid replaced
him. Sid replaced him!
Can I just say, I just find it amazing that if Bully Busick came along today and he was in NXT, he would be like a superstar probably for the gimmick. Just the irony of it. Like the vaudevillians kind of thing.
Yeah, and yeah, real quick, Pete, describe the Big Bully Busick's gimmick at this time period.
You remember the old Warner Brothers cartoons where they had Spike and Chester, Spike the Bulldog, you know, with the derby and the sweater? That was basically Busick. Yeah, and yeah, like the cigar. Yeah, oh, Spike is my hero because he's so brave and strong. that's kind of what it reminded me of. That's just, but it's like a turn of the century kind of like a bruiser kind of guy. He's probably got like barbells and like one of those handle, you know, the unicycle with a big giant bicycle. He probably rode that around from show to show kind of thing.
Yeah, and Nate Busick, who actually was on the Terry Garvin Sins podcast, which has also become a regular plug on this show.
I have to start listening to that one, don't I?
Yeah, it's really, really good. He was on that show, and he's been a policeman for quite a long time in the Georgia area, kind of like Gary Young has been. So it's funny watching these guys go into the police detective work and stuff like that after they get out of the business. But, yeah, Nate Busick.
That's a reality show. Busick and Gary Young, that's a reality show just waiting to happen.
Oh, God, yeah. But Busick definitely, with that turtleneck sweater.
Especially if Busick grew the mustache back out.
Yeah, and wore the derby and had a turtleneck sweater.
And a sweater, yep.
I can't think of Busick.
See? Yeah.
I can't think of him without thinking of Downtown Bruno's book, where he explains that whoever taught Busick how to work evidently didn't do a very good job because he didn't know any insider terminology. He'd always talk about, okay, I'm going to get on the offensive while he's on the defensive, because he didn't know words like selling and getting the heat.
Well, you know where Busick came from.
That would be Georgia All-Star?
Mm-hmm. Well, no. He was a WWF job guy in the late 70s, early 80s. He was Pittsburgh.
Oh, really?
Yeah, he's a Pittsburgh guy. He was in that Bruno crew.
Interesting.
You know, with Johnny DeFazio.
I didn't know he went back that far.
Yeah, Johnny DeFazio and all those, Baron Mikhail Cicluna.
Well,
if
you watch old WWF TV, you see a lot of untrained job guys, so.
Yeah. Right.
That's Nick Busick's pedigree. That's where he comes from, is that crew.
Oh, wow. That's...
And he just ended up in Georgia.
Okay. I did like the little touches that WWF tried to add to the Big Bully Busick gimmick, though, like him popping balloons that Plants had in the crowd.
Yes. Yeah.
You big meaty.
Now, Steve Beverly, who, of course, wrote a tremendous newsletter, Matt Watch, and we've talked about before on the show, just talked about with Nick Busick, he reported the rumor that Kevin Von Erich was going to be joining his brother Kerry in the very soon.
Now, when was that one match that he had with him in WWF?
I think he suffered somebody in Dallas, I think.
But was it before this or after this?
I think it was around the same time. It was around the same time, I think.
Okay.
Or maybe after Kerry left.
I can't remember.
Okay.
I don't remember that. But yeah,
go ahead.
It's something that seemed like it should have happened. You know, Kevin was, you know, had his problems, but I think Kerry and Kevin together in WWF would have been, you know, a pretty good tag team to have on the, you know, on the scene. You know, they had the, you know, the pedigree, and Kerry, they weren't doing a whole lot with Kerry at this time period. So I think it would have been, you know, something cool for him, you know, him to be involved in.
Okay. Looks like Kevin worked a taping in Corpus Christi in December, like a couple weeks after this.
Okay.
So we had one match. He beat Brian Lee, and that looks like that was it for him.
Wasn't there also a tag match? It's not here, or is that like a Photoshop thing? Because there was a photo.
Yeah, I'm on Wrestling Dad. I'm not seeing anything else.
You know how there's a photo of the two of them together working a WWF match?
I've seen that photo, but I don't know.
But it looks doctored, right? Like it was whatever magazine.
It probably was. Kind of like AJ Styles' picks last night for NXT.
I actually managed not to see those.
Also, yeah, a lot of people were falling for that last night.
Also on this Corpus Christi show on December 2nd, Sir Charles, who I believe is the Godfather, right?
Yes.
Defeated an unknown. And also my good friends Ron and Don Harris defeated two unknowns.
I think that was the night after This Tuesday in Texas.
I think in Texas was the 3rd, right? So it's the night before.
Okay. Is it the night before or right after?
Yeah, it's the night before.
Yeah, that's just interesting. That, you know,
going back to RSPW, that's one of the early things I remember was them talking about what a debacle This Tuesday in Texas was, and they had one guy who was at the tapings talking about, Sir Charles, and I think JW Storm was there somewhere. So
yep,
just talking
Chris
about,
Chavez, Chris Walker.
Yep. Just interesting, you know.
They were trying to bring in a lot of different guys, young guys, to try to, you know, get out there, and just didn't work. But, yeah, I think they could have had something with him. They could have done something short-term. At the very least, you know, but oh well.
He was not exactly much of a performer after, depending on your point of view, 84 or 86 or.
Well, after he had his issues, definitely. He was on the downward spiral, I guess you could say.
Yeah. And by the way, since I never chimed it with an earlier, online onslaught exists in a manner of speaking. But it has not been updated since December 26, 2014. And I have to read you, though, what we have as the archives. So the archives go back. WWF Week in Review, December 26, 2014. But after a single week in review, the last thing before that was Ultimate Warrior Dead at 54 8 months earlier.
Can you see if the other arenas are on?
Well,
I think the other arena is completely dead now, isn't it?
Ah. Only on archive.org, I think it exists. But, but back to the WF syndicated television bonanza. On the November 17th episode of Wrestling Challenge, Bobby Heenan mentioned that his guest on the following night's primetime wrestling would be the Big Boss Man, Bret Hart, the Berserker, the Undertaker, and Paul Bearer. Even though a new format for primetime had started the previous Monday, not featuring special guests, showing commentary had been taped weeks in advance before the format was suddenly changed. The reason why the format was changed to a roundtable setting is because the fall ratings have been the worst ever in the history of the show, and this is a new idea to spruce them up. Now, regarding those ratings, cable ratings remain poor. With primetime on that November 18th show doing a 2.3, while All American the day before did a 2.0. Now, the November 4 primetime 2 weeks early had done its all-time low of 1.9, which equaled 1.1 million viewers, and the week before, the first time the show had ever dropped below a 2.1 in its almost 7-year history.
Yeesh.
Yeah, primetime in 1991 was a interesting
was
thing to watch because they went from being the Gorilla Bobby Heenan show with Roddy Piper, then to this deal where they had like a studio audience and Vince in his muscle suits and Bobby Heenan and random shit going on. Then it ended up going to this roundtable format and stuff like that, but I liked the roundtable format personally. I thought it was a fun show.
Yeah, those were good. And they certainly delivered a better high point than the studio audience show because they had the Mr. Perfect turn the following year.
Yeah, yep. Mm-hmm. That was the big standout thing on that show. Actually,
although I guess the studio audience did have Flair's debut, but that we remember that more because it's Flair's debut than anything actually specifically good about it. Mm-hmm. Is there anything that stands out for being especially good? I mean, or just stuff?
Oh, studio audience stuff?
Yeah, I can just think of stuff.
What? Tenru.
I said good, not just for being there.
Tenru being there, that was entertainment personified.
Tenru, Quake Burgers.
Yes. And Vince's Wild Suits.
Andre the Giant and Lord Alfred Hayes making wine.
Who was in the Lucille Ball spot for that one?
Was it Alfred? Wait, was it Andre? It was Andre and... Oh, no, was it Heenan? It was Andre and Heenan, maybe? And like
they were feuding.
Yeah, no, but that was the idea, I think.
Well, maybe like Andre like forcing Heenan into it.
Yeah,
like that sounds familiar. Yeah,
I think what they were trying to do was they were trying to recreate TNT.
Yeah,
and doing that type of show, and then
sort of like half-assed at the same time. Like they weren't sure they wanted to go pull the plug, like pull the trigger completely on it.
Yeah, they didn't want to have like advice for the lovelorn with Skinner or
the dating game.
But
this
in those suits. Yeah, we can't talk about Vince in those suits enough. You have to see Vince. You know, this is right when the WBF is really starting to get pimped.
Yeah, and, so it's like a Zubaz thing almost he was wearing.
It's like a tailored Zubaz suit.
Formal Zubaz.
Okay. Right, if you put Vince McMahon 1991 primetime. And you see, like, all right, there's a Roddy Piper from April 9th. He's wearing that type of suit. Ultimate Warrior on April 30th. He's wearing that type of suit.
I'm trying to remember.
March 11th. He has that type of suit.
I'm trying to remember who came up with the
Ultimate Warrior suit is something else.
I'm trying to remember who came up with the name Bodybuilding Leisure Suit for those, because that's what I always use.
Then we have Bobby Heenan versus Mike Christian in a pose down. And then Venice Beach told Jim. Which Vince's suit in that looks like a early version of the Dudley's wrestling attire. Then you have Brett.
It looks like he took one of the brushes from a car wash.
Then you have Brett when he's wanting his Intercontinental title shot, and Vince is wearing a suit that looked like the attire that the Maximos wear
The boiler suits, yeah.
Yeah, so yeah, go. Go check that out when you get a chance after the show. Watching some of these Vince deals from Primetime Wrestling 1991. But I always dug those roundtable stuff. I thought that was cool. Piper, but Heenan and Henning were really good as a comedy act on that thing, man, playing off each other. And now let's go to Japan and All Japan Pro Wrestling. And the Real World Tag League is in full effect right now. They're drawing sellout crowds every night. Now, as of that Friday night, Mitsuhara Misawa and Toshiaki Kawada were tied with Giant Baba and Andre the Giant, and with Abdullah the Butcher and Kamala 2 with eight points, with Jumbo Shiruda and Akira Taue right behind with 7 points. However, on November 21st in Osaka, during a tag match between Misawa and Kawada against Kenta Kobashi and Tsuyoshi Kikuchi, let me your comb. Masawa's elbow in the eye by Kobashi.
Tsuyoshi Fuji? What?
Masawa's elbowed in the eye by Kobashi, and his eye was swollen shut, and he was out of action as of this Saturday. Any date he misses that a tournament match is scheduled would result in a forfeit, which would take them out of the lead in a hurry.
And also booking for the whole thing.
Exactly. Now, also on that show, which drew 6,400 fans, tying this promotion's record crowd in Osaka, which has traditionally been a hardcore New Japan city and still is to this day. You had Jumbo and Taue go to a 30-minute draw with Gordy and Williams as the main event. Of course, we had the Misawa match, which we previously mentioned. Hanson and Spivey going over Furnace and Crawford. Andre and Baba going over Mighty Inoue and Rush Kimura. Abdullah and Kamala 2 going over Dynamite and Johnny Smith. Dory Funk Jr. and Masafuchi going over my friend Billy Black and Joel Deaton. Then we had... I guess this is Al Perez going over.
Yeah, I think it's Al Perez over Yoshinari.
And listen to this team. Motoko Baba's favorite wrestler, Johnny Ace, and Sunny Beach going over Masao Inoue and Isamu Tiranishi. But, All Japan is hot as hell at this time period. And drawing that big – and All Japan in Osaka was always like a – dead market.
I wasn't aware Furutsu even held that many people. I assume it's Furutsu Gym?
Yeah, well, New Japan drew more than that.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, New Japan.
For some reason, I thought it was a smaller, like 5,800 or something.
No, I think New Japan would draw close to 7. So it was almost capacity. But yeah, I mean, the fact that they're drawing this big in Osaka, which was, even when I was doing Japanese news in the 2000s and just going to the late 90s, yeah, All Japan always struggled in Osaka. It was always one of their worst markets to go to. But they're so hot, they're doing this business. I mean, yeah, if you watch All Japan 1991, you could tell that they were just starting to get ready to peak as a promotion.
What was the historical reason for New Japan being the stronger promotion in Osaka? Like some kind of Inoki thing?
I don't really know, other than they had some really strong local promotion there.
Well, the other thing with All Japan getting hot was that this is starting to build their 20th anniversary, I think, the following spring.
Yes.
Things are just starting to kind of get built to that.
Yeah, Misawa Kawada were at this time, you know, a regular tag team, and
that was a great match. Just awesome. That was the main event.
Yeah, and they were awesome at this time period. The breakup hadn't happened yet, and yeah, this was really good stuff. And the Jumbo Tawei team is really good. Gordy and Doc were, you know, coming into their own as a tag team. Just a lot of strong stuff. But one guy I definitely want to talk about here is my friend Billy Black. And Billy Black and Joel Deaton, what a great underrated tag team they were, Vix. I mean, they don't get nearly enough talk about them.
Yeah, they were just one of those great, like, all-Asian title contender type teams.
Yeah.
I guess is the best way to put it, right?
Like on level the Can-Ams, just that mid-level
work rate team.
Yeah.
And then Billy Black, I mean, was this, like, what's the best way to describe him for someone who's never seen Billy Black? I mean, Joel Deaton, people have seen, because he was, you know, a job guy in Crockett and all that, and Billy Black is kind of like a...
Oh. He was doing like Rednet Lucha Libre.
Well, like a hillbilly who traded a lot of tapes.
But there was this one guy who I'm trying to remember, who's the guy who he looked just like? They were like a singer or someone.
Travis Tritt?
Yeah. Okay, he looked like Travis Tritt in like bad gear, who was trying to do everything he was watching on like Liger and Lucha Libre tapes, but in a good way.
And he did good stuff. I mean, if you watch ECW 1996, Billy Black was just a really fun Kid
Rock thing. He had a bit of a Kid Rock thing going for him too, I think, with the hat.
Yeah,
maybe. Yeah.
Well, early before Kid Rock, he's more.
Right,
I mean,
exactly.
if you lived in Georgia in 1991, Billy Black, that look was very common on the scene. And Travis Tritt was from Georgia too, so I mean that it's that whole look, the mullet and all that stuff going on. I mean, it is, you know, you can picture Billy Black, and I know he did this. Listen to Driving and Crying and stuff like that. You know. Riding around on the roads. So, I mean, they were just a real fun day. And they toured All Japan a lot.
Kentucky Headhunters
is a good call. I mean, they toured All Japan a lot in this time period. And they worked global, and they worked a lot of the Georgia Indies and stuff. But
in global, yeah. Wasn't there the story that Jim Brunzell refused to job to Billy Black?
Yes. Well, I mean, come on, Jim Brunzell. Your time is past, so... Let Billy Black get over on you for God's sake.
What year would this
91.
Be? Earlier in the year.
Yeah,
like
early
Peach,
year.
Like a Peach State?
No, Global.
Oh,
early,
okay.
Early global tape.
He walked out of the world.
I never knew Brunzell actually worked.
He walked out
he
on
did.
The taping.
He walked out.
okay. Understood.
Yeah, but yeah. Again, if you can track down some Billy Black matches, folks, go check them out because he's really good. And Joel Deaton, another great underrated worker.
He was on run two for a little bit, I thought.
Yeah, he did. Exactly.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Now, also in Osaka, the night before, we had FMW running a tag tournament. Well, the first of their night of their tag tournament before 4,855 fans, which is, you know, a decent crowd.
Well, I'm going to say, people think of FMW really, like, kind of starting to really build up steam around maybe 94, 95. But here they are in 91, and, it's Osaka where New Japan was king, but... They're not drawing that many less people than All Japan in a major market.
They were already doing like five-figure crowds, I thought, in 91. They were already getting like 10,000 for their bigger shows, yeah.
They really don't get big enough credit for how big a promotion they were.
Exactly. They don't. They were strong almost from the get-go. They were strong going back in 1990.
And that's without any real TV.
They were like a, exactly. Probably like a number three or a number four at that point, which is nothing to sneeze at considering all the groups you had there.
Yeah, I mean, if they had any TV, it was just an occasional episode on Champs Forum on what I believe at the time was the Music and Sports Power Channel.
Yes.
Yeah.
Was that the same channel network as Gaora? Did that become Gaora, or was it a different one? Just a different entity?
Oh, I don't know.
I thought it was a show that was on Gaora. Now I have like visuals of like...
No, well, Music and Sports Power Channel, if you watch the earlier Champs Forum, is a different network.
Okay. Why are guys and serapes dancing around a star?
Well, that's just Champs Forum. Yeah, I miss Champs Forum a lot. I mean, it was nice when each promotion started to get its own show.
Yeah.
But Champs Forum had a lot of charm.
Mm-hmm. It was just a fun show. Just like this big bouillabaisse, because you'd get the tapes, you'd never know what you were getting. You'd get All Japan Women, it would be Wing, it would be Universal.
And then suddenly, oh, here's the World Wrestling Peace Festival or whatever. Right.
Yeah, it was a total grab bag. You get Michinoku Pro, Battle Arts, stuff mm-hmm. like that.
Fujiwara.
Yeah. Now, on this FMW show, we had Tsuchi Onita and Tarzan Goto going over Big Titan and the Gladiator, Mike Awesome. Then we had, as they're known here, the Soviet judo team going over Katsuchi Ueda and the Shooter.
Who's the other Soviet judo guy? I think Berichev is one, but who would the other guy have been?
I don't remember. I don't remember. Riki Fuji and Sambo Osaka going over the Mercenaries, Billy Anderson and Lou Fabiano, and the Sheik. That's right, the Sheik and Sabu, a young Sabu, going over Mark Starr and Horace Boulder in 1 minute and 12 seconds. Now the story.
Well, it's the Sheik. What do you expect?
Yeah, Sheik.
I know. It's just funny to read it.
Oh, yeah. The story of this show, though, was Onita's reaction as the night before they had All Japan, and they had already sold out before Onita ran his car. And it was well known about that. After Onita's match, he was attacked by the Sheik, and after the Sheik left him laying, he was in the ring bleeding and crying. And instead of talking about the Sheik, he said that this time his group lost his promotional battle over who would draw the most fans in Osaka to All Japan. And he started crying and screamed that it would never happen again.
God bless
forever.
That man. God bless
forever.
Him.
This is total Onita.
There's your lead, ladies and gentlemen, your lead babyface crying about losing an attendance war.
He's shooting in the ring, folks. I mean, he's throwing out. He's basically turned his work into a shoot in the ring and just going off about All Japan beating him at a promotional.
Well, it sure sounds like he worked himself into a shoot.
He definitely worked himself into a shoot. Can you imagine, like...
Priorities.
Yeah, can you imagine if, like Delirious or someone of those guys from Ring of Honor had done this that night they went against NXT, and they're pissed off about how NXT beat them in this battle. I mean, that is just hilarious to think about that, man. He just totally acknowledged all that stuff in the ring, and I bet the fans are like, what the hell is he talking about? Why is this important? Well, that's why it's important, because he damn
something.
Lost some money. Yeah.
I really wish we had more subtitled Japanese wrestling, don't you?
Oh, on Onita? Oh, God, yes. I mean, Onita, just when I used to cover Japanese stuff, you know, one of my favorite highlights was whenever Onita would do these grandstand angles where he would challenge, you know, everybody but God, you know, to a match at a Tokyo Dome, although he did call Inoki God. But, it was just so fun to read him go off into stuff like he would challenge random WWE guys and this, that, and the other. He was dead serious about this. And as a politician, wearing his black jeans, black leather jacket gear at his political office, mm-hmm. I mean, this classic stuff. Onita was a true treasure in this time period. And Pete, you were around in this era. And FMW was just so huge in the internet. It was huge,
but it wasn't really – it's interesting because there wasn't really a whole lot of people actually talking about FMW too much at that point. I mean, the Japanese, there was always – it was New Japan or All Japan. Those were the two. And then All Japan Women as well. People were trading that stuff. They weren't really trading – I mean, there wasn't really a whole lot of activity that I remember for FMW. There might have actually been more interest in Wing for whatever reason at that point. At least getting into like 92 and 91, I don't remember a whole lot of action for FMW. It was more on the periphery, at least.
But it picked up though.
On this side of the pond, oh yeah, it absolutely picked up. But on this side of the pond, there was more any Japanese stuff on RSPW tended to be more towards the big three. It was All Japan, New Japan, or All Japan Women, basically.
Yeah.
Not so much for the shoot groups at that point.
Yeah, Onita became like this huge cult hero here, you know, in tape trading and stuff like that. And this is that early era. And speaking of New Japan, we go to New Japan, and the only show they had during this week was a November 23rd card at Cork and Hall doing their 2000 sellout. You know, they used to do these shows a lot with just, you know, mainly just the Japanese guys. And the main event was an interesting match. You had the Three Musketeers teaming up together on a rare occasion as Muto, Chono, and Hashimoto went over were they still Blonde Outlaws at this time?
Raging Staff, I think they were.
Raging Staff, that's right. Norio Naga, Hiro Saito, and Super Strong Machine with Hashimoto going over Honaga. Now, after the match, the Musketeers said they were all going to concentrate on wrestling as singles wrestlers in 1992, and they were going to compete to see who was become the top wrestler in the promotion. Now, also on the show, we had Jushin Thunder Liger and Koji Kanemoto going over Masaki Urisu and Michiyoshi Ohara, who Dave noted is very reminiscent of his trainer Animal Hamaguchi by count out in 25-21. Mm-hmm. Then we had Osamu Kido, Hiroshi Hase, and Masashi Oyagi going over Akira Nagami, Kuniaki Kobayashi, and Shiro Koshinaka in 2014. Then we had Black Cat going over Black Scorpio, Too Cold Scorpio. That's exactly. But the Muto Chono Hashimoto, you know, dynamic, you know, being the Three Musketeers and all competing to be the top singles guy in the promotion. This lasted for, you know, pretty much the rest of the decade and became, you know, the main deal in New Japan. And it put them in a different light than All Japan because, I mean, these guys were all different in the way they worked. Where in All Japan, you had a lot of the guys that kind of worked the same style. So it made New Japan a different beast. In my opinion, you know, I loved All Japan to death, but I always preferred watching New Japan to All Japan because of that stuff like that.
Did All Japan even have the juniors title running at that point, or was it inactive?
I think it existed, but it wasn't a priority. It
wasn't pushed, yeah.
I mean, eventually, though, we always had that. Like, back then, the thing on the internet, it seemed like, was always you watch New Japan for the junior heavyweights and you watch All Japan for the heavyweights, which was kind of bullshit.
It's a bad narrative.
Yeah.
To be fair, I mean, but you know, like a few months later, you had 92, and you had El Samurai coming out of nowhere, and he was all this, and he was shooting with Liger, and they was like, you know, from the tournament, the junior tournament, when he was just
It was always very unfair,
one of the matches leading to the final.
I mean, but when you look at who we're talking about, the Three Musketeers, Hase,
Sasaki. But when it's like a flash versus sizzle thing.
Even Choshu and Fujinami, you know, whenever they had the big matches, would normally deliver. I mean,
Koshinaka.
Koshinaka, definitely, totally.
Right.
It's just, yeah, and of course the juniors were fucking awesome. There's no doubt about it. But the heavyweights were really good too. They got a raw deal.
Even Super Strong Machine was still really good, at least for another few years.
That whole group was fun. I mean, you had the Raging Staff guys, and then later on, even when the Heisei Ishingun came in, they would be doing the multi-man tag matches, and that was, it was old lumpy heavyweights. There was a lot of energy, and there was a lot of fun action going on back and forth between those guys. So
I'm glad you mentioned Heisei Ishingun because this gives me the chance, and Bixler probably knows where I'm going with this. For you to talk about possibly the best episode of New Japan Television of the decade.
The 95 show?
Yes, where it was basically New Japan Raw as War, and Masa Saito, you got to talk about it. You're the one that turned me onto it.
It was the greatest fucking thing ever. Oh, Jesus. Oh my God. It was like, I think it was Saito, Yatsu, and one of the other guys against Heisei Ishingun. It's a six-man. I think it was a six-man elimination match or a regular tag match. New Japan guys lose the match at the end, and then Saito says, "Fuck this noise! Come here, boys!" And he body slams all seven guys of the Ishingun one by one, black ninja style. It's the greatest thing ever. It's amazing.
Is this on YouTube?
I don't think it is. I wish it was. I would have dug it out.
I don't think I've ever seen it.
Masa Saito bull the woods.
Yeah, and that was like the main highlight of the show.
No, that wasn't even the best thing on the show, because then you had the match later on where it's, Chono, Tenzan, and Saito versus, yeah, Choshu.
Hashimoto and Harada.
Harada, right, where Tenzan pins Choshu out of nowhere. It's like the biggest win of his career at that point. And then Choshu just goes ballistic and he just destroys Tenzan like halfway up the fucking bleachers. Just they're just like obliterating.
It's amazing.
Hash beating up Tenzan all the way into the crowd, halfway up the bleachers, and meanwhile Choshu's getting destroyed because then Shono comes in, Saito, Sabu, and they're just laying it. It's like the most ECW show ever in New Japan history. It's just amazing. You have to, if you can find the show, it's like the greatest 60-minute show, and like in terms of like going, it's basically New Japan going Raw, going ECW. But just like not so sports entertaining and much more nuclear hatred-y kind of thing.
And also you have the whole deal with Choshu and Koshinaka are having their whole deal where they're backstage yelling at each other and
everyone
in the parking lot.
All sorts of cool shit being yelled at each other.
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden here comes Pee-wee Moore wandering by and like, hey, I'm in this show too.
But Tenzan had just joined Murder, Inc. on this show. So he had just done his heel turn because he just came back from Europe. Correct. I mean, it was just a war. Sabu made his debut.
It was a war. It was just a
Remember
war.
Murder, Inc. on this show? I mean, I had to get this in on this show with you on here because I remember watching that show and then your review after. I was like, wait a minute. I don't remember this being that great like that at the time. Oh, then I went back and watched it. I was like, holy shit.
It was
amazing.
One of the best one-hour shows I've ever seen. Just tremendous. If you can find that, track it down, watch it, love it, luxuriate in it. It is fabulous.
Well, I know a certain tape dealer that lives in Pennsylvania that definitely has that show. So,
Sure.
Yeah.
Whatever close your
Yeah, you know, get it. You can find a way to get in touch with that guy, but I know he has it. So, but anyway, All Japan Women came up a while ago as being one of the big three at this time period, and they ran their biggest show of the year on November 21st in Kawasaki, Wrestle Marine Pad 3. Now, the scheduled main event of this show was an old-style Texas death match inside of a steel cage, continuing until both members of one team weren't able to continue, with Bull Nakano and Monster Ripper going against Aja Kong and Bison Kimura in a match that lasted 45 minutes, ending with Kimura knocked out and unable to continue with Khan heavily juicing. Now, after the match was over, Ripper, who brought her WWC World Women's title belt with her, then attacked Nakano, who holds the WWWA title. It wound up with the two agreeing to go back into the cage for a Texas death match to determine who the real champion was. And this match went 33 minutes and 23 seconds and ended with Nakano winning via knockout after putting Ripper out with a sleeper hold. If that wasn't enough, there was yet another marathon technical wrestling match earlier in the show as Kyoko Inoue and Toshio Yamada return from their tour of Mexico and beat Akira Hokuto and Manami Toyota in 32:07. What a show this sounds like.
I don't think I've ever seen this. Is this on tape?
I got to say, Ripper going 33 minutes in 91 is kind of scares me. I don't know about that one.
After going 45!
Basically, yeah. Bull going in like almost an hour and over like an hour and 20 minutes, basically.
This just sounds amazing.
I don't think I've seen any Monster Ripper from this era. I've seen from before, I've seen from after, but I don't think I've ever seen anything.
And for those of you who don't know who Monster Ripper was,
Ronda Singh slash Bertha Faye
in WWF. Yeah, so that's who that was. But yeah, I mean, Bull Nakano, what a performer she was. I mean, God almighty. And to go that long in two separate cage matches. A true testament.
She didn't have the greatest knees in the world to begin with.
Exactly.
Seriously. I mean, her knees were gefilte fish at that point. And to go over an hour and a half, probably with all the extracurricular stuff.
Yeah.
Well, but I mean, it's a Nakano and Kong cage match in that era, so there's probably a lot of like oil can shots and.
Even so, though.
Yeah. Nunchucks.
They're not going to half-ass a main event like that again. It's not like they're sitting there doing rest holds for 20 minutes.
No.
Oh, no. No, no. I'm sure they did a Texas Death Steel Cage match justice. Yes. Especially with Aja Kong and Bison Kimura involved. I mean, you definitely knew that there was some brawling. I mean, it wasn't going to be like a WWE
just a
cage
little,
match.
Just a bit of brawling.
Yeah, just a little. But,
That other tag match just sounds fantastic, too.
Oh, yeah. In that time, because they were also, you know, young and could still go at full strength.
Kyoko was probably my favorite wrestler in the world from that period, that 92-94 period. Just, she was a total package to me. She could just, she could wrestle, she could brawl, she could do the spot, she could just go at a million miles an hour. And just and also tons of charisma. Had the great entrance, had the Panama Van Halen entrance. Just,
yeah, exactly. Like,
just a total, absolute total package.
And we talked about this on previous shows. You know, the 80s era of All Japan Women gets talked about, you know, it's romanticized basically. But again, there's not enough talk about this early 90s run.
Yep.
I mean, among the like people that's of today's, you know, back then it definitely was talked about. But as far as like today's fans of millennials, you don't hear much about it.
No, it seems like you hear more about the 80s stuff if you're going to hear about anything.
Exactly.
I mean, it's more, I feel like, I guess it's more immediately accessible, the 80s stuff, with the heat and everything, and the and hearing about the Crush Gals, and...
Yeah.
Did Pete just mutter Schoolgirls?
Yeah, no, I'm serious. Well. No, I mean, the visual, visual of the Schoolgirls, like, you know, here comes Dump running through the crowd, and you're getting the stampede. They want nothing to do with her. They're screaming, crying, running for their lives. I'm talking about the sheer emotion coming off these girls in waves and waves during as the matches were going on, as the big matches.
Yeah.
That's what I'm definitely talking about. Added to the scene, because by this time period, you know, the shows were being, you know, the crowds were dominated by men.
I'm not creepy.
Well, you know, Japanese men will buy underwear out of vending machines, so you know, we know about them. Like, you know, use women's underwear, so it is what it is, but... But yeah, I mean, and...
To be fair, and this is going to... I mean... We have to remember, though, that the popularity of All Japan Women among male wrestling fans in this era was as it came out of, primarily out of them thinking Aja Kong was cool when she worked on the Universal Lucha Libre shows.
Yeah, it was basically they were kind of like farming themselves out to the other groups. Like, I think they were Wing as well, and that was where the male fandom started kicking. It's like, hey, these kids can go. So that you just kind of took off from there. So that's where that came in.
And it was more Aja Kong than the traditionally pretty, and I'm using the word traditionally pretty, so because no one gets angry at me, type of wrestlers like Toyota that really set off that boom in the first place. I mean, it wasn't Toyota, it wasn't Yamada, even, you know, Kong and Nakano. Yeah,
I wouldn't have kicked Mimi Hagawara out of bed for eating crackers.
The early run was not nearly as creepy as it would get later on, you know, when it got idol.
Well, and Momoe, Nakanishi in general.
You know, when Takako got big, and we know a certain guy who was a huge fan of Takako.
Yeah, well, we know a few.
Yeah,
only one guy? Only one?
Yeah, yeah. We know that one in particular guy who was a bit shady, I guess we could say. But
Is it the one who had the Takako fan website or a different one? I'm not sure who we're talking about.
Initials GT.
Oh, okay.
I was thinking of a different creepy guy.
Would this be someone who traded a friend of ours for South Park tapes?
This is a guy who had a experience with Mike. I think it was Mike Rotundo in an All Japan show.
What?
buying him a beer.
Okay, we're gonna have to talk about this off air.
Allegedly.
I think I know because I know who you're talking about.
Allegedly, right? Yeah.
I mean, I know who you're talking about, but I don't know about this.
Yeah, this seems like a perfect time to go to break, folks. So we're gonna go to break real quick and let the Place to Be boys pay the bills. And I'm gonna, you know, set this record straight with them off the air. And when we come back, we're gonna go to Mexico, and there's a new debut on the scene in the MLL who's about to break out as a huge star. We'll be right back after this.
Promotional consideration paid for by the following.
What's up, everybody? This is Kevin Kelly. Make sure you check out every episode of The Kevin Kelly Show right here on the Place to Be Nation. PlaceToBeNation.com. The Kevin Kelly Show. Every episode is a winner. At least we hope.
Place to Be Nation's Justin Rosero here. In addition to The Kevin Kelly Show, we have a ton of great podcasts available to you on iTunes and PlaceToBeNation.com. You can check out myself and Scott Criscolo on The Mothership, The Place to Be Podcast, home of great interviews and our famous Vintage Vault pay-per-view reviews. If you need your fix of current wrestling talk, we have plenty of options for you there, including Main Events, which features roundtable discussion led by PTBN analysts and special guests, our monthly pay-per-view reaction show, including immediate feedback and discussion for WWE, NXT, Ring of Honor, and New Japan Super Shows, episode, and Wrestling with Optimism, which focuses on the positives of the business. Also, be sure to relive wrestling's past through Graham Cawthon's excellent exclusive History of Wrestling podcast, Dylan Hales and Dave Musgrave's Wrestling Culture podcast, our monthly pay-per-view rewind roundtable series led by Ben Morse, and the Dangerous Alliance podcast starring myself and Pro Wrestling Only's Will, diving into various subjects in the form of exercises and games. Sports fans have plenty to dive into as well. We feature The Extra Point with Scott Griscolo and Dr. G, The Kings of Sport featuring Live Audio Wrestling's godfather Nate Milton, The Sports Lounge hosted by Cowboy and Cowboy Sr., as well as the NBA Team Podcast, which takes a year-round deep dive into pro hoops. PTBN also proudly features Richard and the Mailman podcast, which specializes in the world of TV, thought leadership, anger, and irreverence. As mentioned, all these shows are available on PlacementNation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world. PTBN is also home to the tremendous in-depth features on pro wrestling, sports, movies, comics, plus tournaments, and more. We also want to thank our friends at Bonehead's Wing Bar in West Warwick, Rhode Island, in Fall River, Massachusetts, Scott Keats, RSPWFAQ.com blog, and Piledriver.net.
Do you watch pro wrestling? Do you love pro wrestling? We do too. And there's only one podcast feed that you can't miss.
PWO PTBN Podcast Network. That's the pro wrestling only place to be nation podcast network.
We have a host of brilliant shows dedicated to wrestling past and present.
Whether it's the territories, Japan, Lucha, old school or new school, we've got something for you.
Get a dose of history on Exile on Bad Street with Chris Zellner.
Listen to reviews of current pay-per-views on the PTBN reaction shows. Not just WWE, but New Japan, Ring of Honor, and NXT. And get your weekly update on everything else that's going on in the indies, Lucha, and beyond on This Week in Wrestling.
Relive WCW Supercards on Where the Big Boys Play with Parv and Chad.
Join Dylan Hales and Dave Musgrave on one of the very best shows for super hardcore nerds, Wrestling Culture.
Go deep into WWF history and discover the Bob Backlund and Bruno Sammartino eras on Titans of Wrestling.
Don't miss the Pro Wrestling Super Show with Stephen Graham and Tim Livingston.
You can get the full archive of Good Will Wrestling with Good Old Will from Texas.
There's tag teams back again with Kelly and Marty Sleaze.
Then there's the only pro wrestling game show, Brainbuster, with me, Johnny Sorrow, and a panel of great guests every time.
Get them all on one feed.
PWO-PTBN Podcast Network.
You know you want to hear it.
And we're back, and listen to all those great shows you just heard advertised on that nice little commercial during the break, especially the shows that I am on.
And you've got a good one that is either, are we assuming it's going to be up by now?
Yeah, well, again, we'll talk about that towards the plug, so definitely look out for that show. So
yes,
and now that since we're in Lucha Libre, we have to do the obligatory
other plug.
David Bixen's fan plug of the week. For the great guys at LuchaShop.com. So the floor is yours.
Yes, if you want to save 10% off your order at LuchaShop.com, which has all of your fine official Lucha Libre merchandise from shirts to masks to little keychain dolls and all sorts of things, use coupon code BIX. I think as we're recording this, but not after recording this I think he said they're going to be out of La Sombra shirts, right? Because
We're in the stretch run of Sombra shirts because he's now a member of NXT.
Yeah,
I
guess I think Kevin's doing it as a time sale, but I mean, so this we're recording this not the night before it goes up, so I don't know if it's still going to be there when this is up, but. You know, they still have the rest of the Ingobernable shirts too. So,
yeah, of course, Naito, Rush, La Mascara. So
those seem to be the big sellers right now.
Marco, yeah.
Yeah, I'm sure. Sure Marco's a big seller. Jesus.
Hey, Marco. Hey, in all honesty, Marco in Mexico is probably the biggest star of all of them.
But from anyone who's going to buy from Lucha,
he's crossed over.
But not anyone who's
crossed over.
But on Lucha Shop.
No, maybe not. I'm talking about in Mexico. He's the biggest mainstream star.
No, I know.
Big soap opera star.
I know. And
he's one of the big girly pop guys.
Lots of other.
Andy, you know, Andy's married to one of the hotter Etikonis of the era, Miroslava. So props to him on that one.
Yeah, you know what? Kevin needs to work on getting some official Etikonis merchandise. I bet that'll drum up some additional business, wouldn't it?
For the Etikonis chokers, yeah. Pretty sure they would. Playing off our bit from earlier.
They can sell it at the front counter at Sola Para Hombres.
Oh. But, yeah, definitely. Oh, somebody asked if they could use the coupon code BIX for like sites like Brazzers. Is that
Jesus.
Reality Kings.
Reality Kings, yeah.
Did you see the thing about Eva Marie today?
Yeah, Brazzers offered her a spot if wrestling doesn't go right for her.
Well, didn't they? Weren't the exact words, if this wrestling thing blows up in your face?
Yes.
Which is, there's the terrible porn pun thing, but also I like that they're clearly aware that she's a terrible wrestler.
Yeah. Yeah, Brazzers embracing wrestling.
If, air quotes.
Yeah. But anyway. Oh. Get back on track here as we go to EMLL. As yes, there's no AAA just yet.
There's no is there even a CMLL yet?
Yeah, but it is still EMLL. All right. But EMLL on November 17th at Arena Mexico saw the Mexico City debut of Ultimo Dragon, teaming with, or as he was known at this time, the Ultimate Dragon in the newsletters.
No eyeballs.
Yeah, teaming with Octagon y El Dos Santos to beat Fuerza Guerrera, Sangre Chicana, and Emilio Charles Jr., which is an awesome Rudo team, when Dragon pinned Chicana with a moonsault body block.
Speak to now, me, little dragons.
Fiera was so great back then.
I'm putting this into the ground.
Ultimo Dragon, I mean, when he came on the scene, it was so different, you know, because he had that, he was one of the early guys to do that Lucha Risu style in Mexico, and throwing the kicks, and yeah, it was really awesome to see him mix it up with these guys.
Yeah, it was just different. I mean, his style was mostly the same when he used his real name, right? I mean, he did the kicking a little bit more as Dragon, right?
Yeah,
as when he was just Asai, it was a little bit more of a straight lucha style, and it was just different. And
his style was kick.
I forget. Oh, now I'm trying to remember, who was it that said that?
He wore kick pass because he liked to kick.
No, but who was the his style is kick line from?
Oh shit, Davey? No.
No, it was recently, wasn't it?
David Richards for some reason. I don't know.
Low key.
No, but who was the wrestler who said it?
It was like one of the Evolve guys, I thought.
And it was a Japanese guy who said it, I thought.
Oh, I thought it was one of the Evolve guys.
No, I thought his style is... I thought there was a Japanese guy who said recently about someone, his style is kick. And I think... I'm trying to... When would you say his peak as a worker was? Because I feel like he has, like, a couple different ones. Like, I think he as a Sai, he's really good. And then, both in from what we, the little we have in Mexico and in Universal, and then... Some when of the early first, Ultimo Dragon stuff, but then
that early Ultimo Dragon stuff when he first came in was just phenomenal.
But more in Mexico than Japan, though. More in Mexico than Japan,
right? More Mexico, like because we actually had, you know, I came back for break from college, and there was like suddenly, oh, we have EMLL on TV now. We have Galavision, so I was just be watching that because I was a freak, and just the style. Just he came in and it just like just amazing. Even as varied as that group was, he really stood out. Because it was just totally a totally different style from anyone else, and just got over like gangbusters.
Yeah, I mean, you know what's weird is, so to go with what I was going to say is, in Japan, he really didn't click until like 96. Like, yeah. Wrestling in Japan and then in the United States from there, which is, you know, closer to style to the Japanese style.
I would say 95, because he was having the blowout matches.
Yeah.
That got him.
Late 95. I would say late 95.
I would say summer 95 too, because the Jericho match was in 90, was over the
well. Here's
summer.
What I'm going to say:
July 7th, I think July 7th.
Well, I was going to say to that is there's a Jericho though. Jericho, you're at least, that's a guy who's kind of a guy with a good lucha, more of a lucha base though. Like as far as wrestling, more of a Japanese style. I think it's more like the end of the year because then he has the J Cup and he has his best match with Liger up to that point. He has the Otani match, the first Otani match.
Yeah, also War had a different. They ran their own junior tournament, I think, that over that either spring or summer. That
The Battle
that's
Angel show with 1-2-3 Kid.
That's what I'm saying. Yeah, I mean,
with 1-2-3, and also I think Brett Como doing the Ultimate Dragon.
Yes.
Yes. Exactly. And that was the deal when, you know, there was a guy in the South in Georgia that was working as
the Mike Jackson trainee.
Mike Jackson trainee. So there's been a lot of Ultimate Dragons, but yeah, Ultimo, I mean, in this time period, he was really fun on these shows. And
how could all these guys be the Ultimate Dragon?
Yeah, oh, because ultimate means singular. Yeah.
Well, you would think
with everybody, like the last.
Yeah.
Well, you would think there would at least be a penultimate dragon.
Yes.
Anti-penultimate. Yeah. No, that would be a great trios team. Anti-penultimate dragon, penultimate dragon, and ultimate dragon.
Yeah. But, I mean, there were so many guys on the scene in this time period that were, you know, he was mixing it up with, and one of them was Octagon, who retained his Mexican national welterweight title, beating El Hijo del Gladiador, who's now a member of the booking committee at EMLL, and on 11/20 in Mexico City. I think this was at Arena Pista Revolucion. And on November 22nd at Arena Mexico, we had these matches. We had Blue Panther, Angel Blanco Jr., and Petoff Jr. going over Love Machine, Art Bar, Black Magic, Norma Smiley, and Mascara Sagrada by DQ, and Machina and Mass Panther in a 2.5-star match, of course, setting up their deal. Then we had the Dragon debut on Galavision, teaming up with Io Del Santo and Mysterioso. So a team of a Japanese guy, a Mexican guy, and an American, being the hot heel trio of Fuerza Guerrero, Emilio Charles Jr., and La Fiera.
Did they play up the American thing with Mysterioso?
Not really.
Until he turned heel in AAA.
Not until the Gringos, right.
Yeah, and Mysterioso made Guerrero submit in 1741. Dave Meltzer said he was told that Santo Dragon, Guerrero, and Charles were excellent in this match.
And that's a really, really good match on paper.
Yeah, really. For late 91, there's nothing wrong with a match where Mysterioso is the worst guy in the ring. Because all those guys could go, seriously.
Yeah, exactly.
Fiera was phenomenal back then.
Oh, God, yeah. I mean, all these guys. I mean, this was a hot-ass promotion. Then you had Conan, El Dandy, and Anibal going over Nitron, Cien Caras, and Mascara Año 2000.
What were you saying about this phenomenal crew? Because Nitron's kind of like the exception.
Well, I'm trying to figure out. This is 1991, so who's the worst worker, Nitron or Anibal?
Oh, God. Anibal was so bad. And he was, you could say Nitron was worse just because Anibal was good. He was just totally shot at this point because he was just back to just drop his mask.
I mean, and credit to Mascara Año 2000, who had that mask match with him, which is one of the greatest carry jobs in the history of professional wrestling.
Exactly.
I mean, and then Anibal, I think, does that. Chucho wins by DQ, right?
Yeah.
It was a really fucked finish.
And then it's like this really uneventful unmasking, and then Anibal unmasks and looks like Angelo Mosca.
he looked like Methuselah. It was just a bad match, and it's just like the worst way to look at afterwards. Like, you have guys like Psychosis and Sombra and Ray who have a cool look after
Hoobie.
They take a hood
buff. Hoobie.
I wouldn't say Ray, actually.
But Hoovy and Psychosis and Sombra, Black Warrior, awesome look.
Silver King,
yeah. But then you have the other guys like when Blue Panther lost the mask, when Pierre Up lost the mask, and the hoods come off, and it's just like they're just these old guys. It's sad.
Pierre Up figured out a way to make that work for himself eventually.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Well, Pierre Up also Pierre had like nuclear level charisma too, which helped a lot.
Yeah, exactly. And then Anibal made the MA2K submit in a 0.5-star match with Dave saying Anibal was awful, but Dandy and Conan were doing lots of Midnight Express moves. But the main event of this show were the finals of the CMLL World Trios Titles Tournament, and the first champions were the new Infernales, Pirata Morgan, MS Uno, and Satanico. Beating Los Brazos, Oro, Plata, and Brazo in 1802, when Morgan pinned Brazo de Oro in a third fall. There were 5 consecutive dives out of the ring in the third fall. Even though both teams are heels, they both work babyface style to get over the importance of the title belts. The title match.
Style.
Main event wrestling.
This is only 2.25 stars, but this is also the very beginning of Dave watching Lucha regularly.
Yeah, well, he had been watching for like a full year by this time period, but yeah. And of course,
and it's weird because he was in L.A. all those years. You would have thought he would have seen the earlier stuff, like when these guys, like when Brazos were working L.A., when all the other guys were coming in and working the territory as well.
Well, he's in Northern California.
Yeah, he was in San Francisco.
Oh, I thought he was in L.A. Okay, no. I thought he was down southern.
I mean, he lived in L.A. at some point, but he was San Jose Bay Area, that stuff.
Right. Okay.
And real quick, before we talk about more of this, so Atlantis beat Parada Morgan on November 23rd in Pueblo to keep the NWA middleweight title.
You know, but real quick. I'm just reading this stuff, though, and thinking, like, every one of these shows would be on tape, some of them live-streamed if they happened today.
I know, in today's time period. But, Pete, Los Brazos in 1991, this is when they're really starting to become, you know, technicos in a lot of ways because the fans were really behind them. They were coming out to the Looney Tunes theme. And this was also the era of one of the greatest skits.
You were setting this up. Libre,
the Christmas, which, the Brazos dreaming skits where they're all wearing the little pajamas and their hats.
Yeah.
So please elaborate on the greatness of this skit.
Oh, Jesus. So the Brazos, they're all like, I forget if they're in like their little bunk beds or something, but they're all dreaming about, just having dreams about what they'd rather be doing. Like, I think El Brazo, he's a rock star. He's playing Unskinny Bop by Poison. He's just playing the dickens out of his little guitar. God bless his soul. Oro, I think he's a businessman. He's a big businessman. He's an important businessman. And Porky has a big sandwich. That just really got over. It just really got over the import. Brazo's the big flashy corny guy, and then Oro's like the serious guy, and then Porky's the eating guy.
People today, if you weren't watching CMLL before, like. Really, before their TV just kind of stopped getting played in the U.S., you just don't know the greatness of the CMLL skits.
They went for a good 10-plus years. They really stopped in the early 2000s, probably around 2003.
We need a comp tape of all the Lucha skits.
But yeah, in 1991, 2001, I mean, there were just so many great skits. And a lot of them involving Porky and food.
Yeah.
Like whenever he would visit Super Astro's restaurant, eating the torta. The Super Torta. And stuff like that.
They did one of those bits where Porky was at Super Astro's place, and he brought one of his sons. Might have been, was it La Máscara? Is that his son? One of them?
Yeah.
Okay.
No, yeah. Máscara is Oro's son.
Oh, okay.
Porky's son is Psycho Clown.
There's so many Alvarados that you trying to keep them all apart.
Maximo and Psycho Clown are Porky's sons.
Okay,
so it might have been Psycho Clown in his older gimmick, but. Yeah. But Porky's eating the sandwich, and every time I see one of those big giant Astro sandwiches, it's like the Bugs Bunny cartoon with Tasmanian Devil, where he's making the big giant salad, and you've got like squirrels and birds in the salad. and his son is just shoots him this awesome. Are you really going to eat that thing, Pop?
Okay, nothing though tops. I mean, nothing from that era, though. I mean, because the best of the older ones is the one we were talking about, but from the early 2000s, though, is, of course, my personal favorite, Que Doctor.
Wagner General?
Which is Dr. Wagner Jr. treating a patient in his office.
X-rays?
He's just a practicing doctor. Suddenly, he sees Black Tiger, who is, you know, his Silver King in full gimmick, but it, like,
oh, we're thinking of two different skits here, but you go on.
For some reason, we're never, like, it's, you're supposed to know, but not really supposed to know that Black Tiger, Silver King, and they're brothers, but then Silver King is Black Tiger, turns into a black cat, an actual real kitten, which Wagner then goes up to, picks up, and throws out the window.
With a big wacky...
the best show... I know we're getting way off track here, but the best show...
Of course we are, we should.
That of all skits, was the Halloween 2001 show, which features Shocker turning into the Hunchback of Notre Dame.
Yeah.
You have Dr. Wagner Jr. becoming Dr. Frankenstein, Wagnerstein. And you had the awesomest skit of Suki... The very small mini, who would be the monkey in T2P, Venencia.
And also Max Mini.
Max Mini, other gimmicks, Baby Rabbit and stuff like that.
Mini Rey Mysterio Jr.
Mini Rey Mysterio Jr. And he was being chased by a guy that looked like the villain from Scream. And it was just, what a show that was.
So many great skits.
I'm going to bring up the other skit I thought Bix was going to talk about with Wagner. It's Universo. It's the capos. It's Universo. It's Mascara Año, Cien Carson, Apollo Dantes. And Universo, I think he'd gotten a pile driver from Paraguay, so they're taken to the hospital. And which doctor do they see at the hospital? Dr. Wagner. And he's playing it completely straight, too. He's just sitting there. He's giving Universal the x-rays, and they're giving the x-rays, and he's standing there doing the Wagner pose. And he's like, look at the x-ray. Perfecto capos. It's just beautiful. Just you need someone to do that comp tape. Someone do the Lucha, yes, the Wax Lucha skit comp tape.
And we
someone
can't forget the Barriqua skits with Veneno with his straw hat dancing around.
Or Aluche being convinced to join the Barriqua. No, but and when they convinced Aluche, who's now Caimanito, to join the Barriquas by giving him candy.
And of course, Pet Pig.
Or Shocker giving the other crap.
The guapos?
Yeah, swerving them on the hair job. Yeah.
That was his heel turn. I mean, that was his babyface turn.
That was his face turn. Yeah,
because he was a heel with the guapos, and he was like, "Hey, I'm actually handsome. You guys are ugly and think you're handsome because you're blonde."
It was Shocker's epiphany.
And then you had like Porky's Pig, you know, and that whole deal with the burrito was gonna cook him. Then you had
Wagner and Shocker bowling.
Yeah, Wagner and Shocker bowling. You had Gigante Silva playing basketball against the Minis.
Yes.
I mean, there was just so much going on that. It's just, also, Tonico and his lair.
Yes, when Vero and Mephisto.
Yeah, Sitar and Desert Boy, yeah.
And the skit where Vero and Mephisto got the gimmick.
Little Satan view screen.
Yes. Then the Averno Mephisto debuts, that whole thing. Classic stuff.
And with the guapo thing, and we'll end on this before moving on. I love that the whole blonde hair means your guapo thing, that when Caimanito became, first he's just the Blue Monkey, or he was, people forget, he was just a Mascota de CMLL. But then he joined the guapos, and he got his blonde wig. And that's what made him Caimanito.
He's always had great gimmick continuity with whoever he's aligned with.
Yes.
Like dressing up as Niebla, as Felino.
Yes, people don't know that. People remember that Caimanito is a portmanteau. It's basically the meaning is that beautiful little monkey.
Exactly.
So the name Caimanito is a relic of him being in the guapos, or the new guapos, the Shocker guapos.
Exactly.
So now we have to move on to the UWA, which never would have ever booked anything like that.
Yeah, which UWA didn't even have television.
They were starting at this time period.
This time period was actually the start of their television.
Yeah, let's put it this way. The UWA never had television when they drew money.
Exactly. Now, on November 17th at El Torreo in Nacopan, we had Ricky Santana, Miguel Perez Jr., and Gigante Warrior going over the neck. Fishman and the Killer.
Ooh. Well, that's 4/6 of a good match.
In a battle of the heels with Perez, Kenny Connect.
Well, 4/6 of a relatively decent match.
Well, but which four? Yeah, Ricky, Miguel.
And not giant Warrior and Killer.
Fishman is maybe three and a half of a...
Fishman and Connect are good enough that against Santana and Perez, I think they could do something with them.
I never really felt Fishman when he was in AAA. I guess he's past his prime at that point. Never really got that vibe about Fishman.
Anyway,
moving on.
But I mean, a battle of the heels and Perez pinned Connect to win the third fall after pinning him to win the first fall. So Connect did some jobs there, but it set up a title match, which took place Sunday at Torreo, which of course Connect won. Also on this show, we had the Tenableses.
In the greatest match in the history of the world.
And Viano Tessera going over this six-man team. Nightmare Danny Davis, Dirty White Boy Tony Anthony, and Kokina, who would go on, of course, to become Yokozuna. What a team that is.
That's a war six-man right there.
Definitely. Now, also, we had Negro Casas retaining his UWA World Middleweight title on November 20th, and Arena Neza beat Ruben Garcia. Then we had the Headhunters, who we talked about in depth last week.
Every week.
Who are heading in during December. And also in early 1992, scheduled to debut are Gennaro Contreras Jr., the son of Ringo Mendoza, and Mil Máscaras Jr. Mm-hmm. The latter debut will no doubt gain a lot of attention. Dave says he's got to feel sorry for anyone trying to work using that ring name. Although Ilho Dos Santos didn't do too badly for himself, and El Santo was a bigger deal in Mexico than Máscaras.
Okay, what happened here?
Never heard of him.
And I don't think none of these ever happened. I don't remember Contreras working, and I definitely don't remember Mil Máscaras Jr.
Now, does he have sons that would have been the right age?
I really don't know.
Now, how much older than Dos is he?
Oh, God.
I think he's about 10 years older, I think. I think Dos was like 45 when he worked the J-Cup the 1 year.
Okay, and Ricardo, Dos, I mean, not Ricardo, so Ricardo's Dos his manager. Is, Alberto Dos, is 38, so.
Dos is 64, Mil 73. So 9 years.
And Alberto is 38, so around this time he would have been 14.
Dos was born in 51.
So he would have had an age, he could have had an age-appropriate son, for sure. He could have, I just don't know how old his kids would be. Factually.
Junior? I mean, Jesus. That's just like, you know, that's... And yeah, all the, you know, there's so many sons that go into the business and whatever, but wow, that's just... That's tough.
But then you have all the guys who are just like, you know, renting out the gimmick name, basically, too.
Yeah.
So it could be either one.
And it also could have been a situation, too, where guys would try to get, you know, get over on him as revenge of the father. Because, you know, how Mil was. That could have been a bad situation for him. But
He probably just found some guy who looked like Thunder and then had a falling out with him.
Yeah.
Just Thunder.
And now we're going to go to the Global Wrestling Federation. And November 22nd, they taped some shows for ESPN, drawing 700 fans at the Sportatorium.
How dare you?
The Global Dome, excuse me. And the first hour of the taping, which airs on December 16th, we had a couple interesting things. We had the California Connection, John Tatum and Rob Price becoming the new global tag team champions. And here's what happened. The champions were Conan, Chris Walker, and Steve Simpson. Walker, who quit the promotion a few weeks back to join the WWF, was announced as having his plane delayed, so he wouldn't be able to make it for the match, which Dave, the plane was hijacked to Stamford, Connecticut, no doubt. So Marcos Villas, the GWF commissioner
from Barcelona, Spain, of course,
Barcelona, Spain, told Simpson he would have to defend the belts himself or lose them. So Simpson won the handicap match and ended up being pinned by after Price hit him with nunchucks.
Which
and
I don't remember. I don't remember the nunchucks.
Yeah, I remember the handicap match. Yeah, but not that part of it.
The second hour of taping saw the Body Snatcher, a guy doing an Undertaker gimmick, and said it looks like a smaller Bam Bam Bigelow.
I don't remember that at all.
Apparently that was Louis Spicoli.
That's what
I've seen. I looked him up on Wrestling Dead. It says it was Louis Spicoli doing that gimmick. Yeah.
Okay.
And he beat the Avenger, who was Jerry Lynn under a mask. And then we had this match. We had Sweet Daddy Falcone and Rob Price going over Bill Irwin and Rattlesnake Jeff Rates with a strange finish. During the match, Falcone rolled out of the ring and claimed his knee went out. Tatum then jumped in and started teaming with Price, and the ref allowed it. When announcer Craig Johnson went to ask the ref told Johnson that the contract stated the coast-to-coast connection and not to any two individuals, so he felt it was legal for Tatum to substitute. Johnson did ask if a contract was made out to the Wild Bunch, Black Bar, Irwin, and Rates, if they could do the same thing, and the ref said yes. So expect some kind of angle to come out of that statement.
We're going to freebird each other.
Exactly.
The two worst freebird rules tag teams ever.
Yeah, I guess you could say that.
I like a lot of those guys, but yeah. Really.
Not for some of their parts.
Tatum ended up pinning Rates, and the main event of the taping saw Steve Simpson pin John Tatum after Price accidentally hit Tatum with a nunchucks. Then the third hour, wasn't a whole lot going on there. So, but yeah, I mean, it's some interesting stuff going on, but Global's going through a change here, which we'll talk about in a second. But as there's some problems with the Patriot, as they aren't Titan related, WF related. Apparently, Bill Eady, the Masked Superstar, trademarked several of the gimmicks, the Handsome Stranger, the Patriot, etc., to Galaxy Corporation, Carol Lindsay, and Danny Overstreet, who were the original money backers for the GWF. And Galaxy Corporation and GWF are no longer the same thing. There are rumors that Galaxy is still interested in staying in the wrestling business, in which case they would claim ownership of the Patriot gimmick and character. Now, Bix.
Oh, hell if I know.
The Galaxy Corporation never did anything else, but this is the, I mean, this is right. This is the people that saved Joe Pedicino.
You mean after Mr. Olu Oleami did whatever he did? Yeah. You know what this reminds me of? Remember when Panda Energy was going to split from TNA and run opposition, and which yes. never happened? So this sounds like that, only like, you know, 15 years earlier or whatever. That I was really sad when that did. Do you realize what a disaster, amazing disaster that would have been? That's the way the TNA would have gone out of business. Now this happens.
I'm just cracking up for Christmas spelling, mispronouncing Handsome Stranger because I think Handsome Strangler would have been an awesome gimmick.
Well, I'm sure Bob Bagwell may strangle some people.
That would just be a great way to to turn him heel and just be like, he's actually saving, you know, because, you know, the whole Handsome Stranger thing was that he was saving himself for his wedding night or whatever it was. And then it just, you find out that it's all part of some twisted thing and he's actually a gigolo.
real life.
Yeah, he's something like that. But he's actually some kind of crazed George Gigolo serial killer.
I mean, that's not a promised necklace.
Yeah, Marcus Bagwell, he's a pure guy. I mean,
pure something.
But speaking of Bill Eady, he has been replaced on the booking committee by Eddie Gilbert, mainly because the Atlanta office shut down and he didn't want to work out of Dallas. Joe Pedicino told Matt Walsh that Gilbert offered his services, and they were glad to have him on board. And the definite—you could tell a definite difference in the product from when
you mean Billy, it got better.
Yeah, when Bill Eady was in charge, and then when Eddie Gilbert took over, no doubt.
Eady had some interesting booking ideas. I think that's the best way to put it. He was the one who came up with all of the global folklore, you know, with the Barcelona, Spain, and being a promotion.
English lords.
Being the biggest promotion in the world. They just didn't have any American presence. And the tag team champions had been the English lords who had a car accident on the Autobahn and they had to retire. So they had a tournament. But
it's a very, very Matt Stryker-esque on this.
Yeah, so the world
has all sorts of bullshit being pulled out of the air.
The world heavyweight champion is Baron von Steiner, who we'll be seeing soon, but for now we're crowning a North American champion.
I'm picturing that as Bully Busick's old gimmick, just repackaging this Baron von Steiner, just with the same look.
Global was just so interesting to watch because, you know, the ESPN stuff. The ESPN stuff was like you get your syndicated stuff, which was, you know, pretty timely. And ESPN stuff was just a hodgepodge of everything.
Right. New stuff, old stuff.
You would get guys wrestling three times on the same show. And different taping dates.
Yeah, I remember, and then, you know, when they just stopped showing new stuff on ESPN eventually in, like, 92, 93, I love, in the Shannon Namaki post, it's like a quote book, and it's something like, over and over, it's like, I'm Doyle King, you're watching Global Wrestling Federation on ESPN, and this week we'll be seeing the Patriot in action. You know, just over and over after the Patriot had been gone from Global for, like, years.
And speaking of the Patriot, he was told over the week that the WF didn't have any room for him right now, but may be contacted again in 1992, which, Pete, of course, never happened.
They told him to work on his upper body some more?
Yeah, he wasn't jacked enough then.
And then when they finally brought him in, I mean, it was just right when he got injured, but he had become a really good worker.
Well, he had already been WCW by then, you know?
And that too, I mean,
All Japan.
Yeah, Del Wilkes is a guy.
He had bad timing, though, with the American promotions.
Yeah, but Del Wilkes was a really good worker when he was on, you know?
I mean, he wasn't even bad when he was green. He had a lot of potential. He always had a lot of potential.
Yeah, it was there.
He had a great look as a Patriot, I thought.
He had a great look with or without the mask.
Yeah, but yeah, the Patriot. I mean, he was the bell cow on Global for this early run.
Even when he was the Trooper in the AWA, you could tell there was something there. He had something going.
Charismatic, solid promo.
Yep. Good look.
Yeah, and very. But yeah, then later on, I mean, he really. I mean, in All Japan, I mean, he doesn't get enough credit for how good he was. I mean, he was never pushed as like a top foreigner. But I mean, he was Kobashi's tag team partner a lot.
He was a good hand, I think they would say.
I would put him above the a good hand level.
I thought he was a good worker. I mean, he was good in WCW with Bagwell. They were a really good tag team together, which is funny since, you know, they were global guys. And then, you know, when he had that short run in WWF, you know, the Brett match and other, I mean, he had some good stuff. It just, injuries caught up to him. His timing was bad. And speaking of timing, Scott Hudson, his timing is done in global as he's put his notice in over the week as he was tired of the travel to Dallas over the weekend. And according to Matt Watch, he'll be done after the start of the new year, which he was replaced by Bruce Pritchard.
Poor Baldy Locks.
Yeah, Scott Hudson. Him and Craig Johnson. I mean, that was probably the earliest example of two guys announcing wrestling for the smart crowd.
Yes. Definitely.
Which,
I mean,
you know, Joey Styles would take that to the next level in ECW, but, you know, Craig Johnson and Scott Hudson were so great together. And
when you saw all the guys they were bringing in, like Gordy and Cactus, and they would be name checking a lot of the All Japan stuff. So it was definitely a lot of influence on probably wouldn't surprise you at all if he was one of those guys working on RSPW, just trying to get a feel for what was going on.
Was a directive from Joe Pedicino, because that's what Joe liked. Joe wanted to, I mean, everything was in, you know, all the wrestling world was a fair game, you know. And that goes back to if you're watching NWA 1989, you know, when Joe had a little pull at the time, you know, you watch those early like wrestling news networks where Gordon Solie's talking about, you know, WWF angles on NWA television, you know, I mean, that's just the way that Joe was. It just didn't matter. You know, there wasn't no walls there. We could talk about other guys and other promotions on our shows. It don't matter.
My favorite being when Tommy Rich does his heel turn. And he's just Joe on his new segment on Global is just so sad that he's making this fool of himself by insisting on being called Thomas Rich and that whole thing. And
but Tom Rich had never been heel before,
but he never betrayed his roots and gotten yeah. corporate and sold out as a he was true to his roots as a Tommy.
Yeah, exactly. He was Uncle Tom, I guess you could say.
Oh, that's terrible.
Speaking of Georgia, on November 20th at Lasseter High School in Marietta, before 375 fans, we had this great card, Hillbilly Festus.
This is not global, by the way. We should. This is our potpourri for the week.
Yeah, this is potpourri.
Because Global did run one show in Marietta, ever.
Yeah, and this is like
They switched titles on their
team. Light heavyweight title. They did a light heavyweight title switch, and that ended up being the only global show ever outside of Texas, right?
Yeah, and this is a Peach State wrestling show, if I'm going to say, or a sponsor show involving Peach State guys.
I know, but it was a Peach State show.
Yeah, and Hillbilly Festus, who was Billy Starr, beat if you watch the old Mid South tapes from
and
the early
also 80s. Billy Starr of the Fake Nightmares fame,
and Ted Allen's partner in the Fake Nightmares. Beat Steve the Brawler Lawler. Then you had Jimmy Powell going over to a double count out with Ronald P. Gossett.
Oh, I need to see that. Ronald P. Gossett in single action.
Yeah, R.D. Swain going over the Night Stalker, Brian Clark, by DQ.
Clark was everywhere back then.
Yeah, when the PYTs.
Except the wrestling school.
Yeah.
Well, that's
yeah.
what you get when you're trained by Oxbaker.
Yeah. And this is a different PYTs. This is at Norval Austin and Coco Ware.
Who is this? Randy Rhodes and Eric Fontaine?
Yeah. Then you have Sugar Ray Loy, the Great Glacier, and Steve Day.
Glacier.
Yeah, who I'll be seeing wrestling this weekend in Barnesville, Georgia. and Steve Day, who was the wrestling coach at Lasseter, who placed fourth in the 1978 World Games, won the Canada Cup, took two silver medals in the Greco-Roman World Meet, and was a 1980 Olympic team member when the U.S. boycotted. They went over the PYTs. And then you had your main event match.
This is quite the main event.
Junkyard Dog and Ranger Ross going over Stan Lane and Jim Cornette in 12 minutes, an almost all comedy match. And you had a battle royal where JYD won.
Who was Cornette subbing for? That's what I want to know.
I think he was working with as Lane's partner on a lot of indie shows at that time.
Yeah, were just doing comedy matches. Ah. No shows included the Wild Samoan, whoever that would have been, Pez Watley, and Mr. Wonderful Paul Orndorff.
Who is probably dead or rumored to be dead somewhere at the time.
He was living in Fayetteville, Georgia, which is just right down the road, running this bowling alley. But those Peach Day shows were a trip, man. And Lane and Cornette were fairly regular on all those shows in this era before Smoky Mountain really got started.
Peach Day was another one of those early things on RSPW. There would be always guys. I think they brought in the Sheik, the original Sheik, for one of those shows.
Yeah, I mean, they were bringing everybody.
I was going to say the same thing. Like, you look at Peach Day results, like, is there anyone who didn't work there? Like, they'd bring in guys who were in, like, major promotions. Like, they'd get dates on guys.
Yeah, they would run Stan Lane and Buddy Landell as a regular tag team on occasions on those shows.
Like, and when they had those shows in 96 with the Steiners, wasn't that after the Steiners started back with WCW?
Yeah, that was when they were working against, and that was shows that had Raven and Rob Van Dam and Scorpio, and Cactus Jack was on those shows working for WWF.
Barbarian putting someone through a table with a headbutt to the floor, I think.
So they were running all kinds of wild shows in this era. But, it was a fun little promotion. That was a Ben Masters promotion. Of course, his son Dan Masters is a ring announcer in the South, in Georgia and other places. So good guys. And we move on to another Southern territory, the USWA. And on November the 18th at the Mid-South Coliseum in Memphis, they also had a tag tournament where the winning team supposedly got $100,000, which is hard to believe.
Well, what was the gate?
Turkish dollars.
Turkish dollars, yeah. They were francs or something.
Zimbabwe dollars.
Yeah, they were Joe Pedicino's Nigerian dollars. And they got a trip to the Japanese tournament. Okay, and your winning team was Jeff Jarrett and Jerry Lawler. What a shock, going over Billy Travis, Billy Joe Travis, and the Grave Digger, another fake Undertaker. And the other teams and others in this tournament was Dr. Tom Pritchard and Jimmy Valiant, Eric Embry and Kamala, Dutch Mantel and Brian Christopher. You had Bill Dundee and the Spirit of America. And you had the super team, Jeff Gaylord and Big O. Not so super there.
Well, who is Big O?
I don't know. I don't remember. Memphis at this time period, which we'll talk about in a minute, they were bringing in all kinds of like different types of guys, a lot of Larry Sharp guys and stuff like that.
Now, weren't Jeff Jarrett and Jeff Gaylord also called the Super Team?
I think so.
Now, apparently, Gravedigger was a Demolition Blast, the other Demolition guy.
Also, was there more than one Demolition Blast? Because I've heard that too.
I don't remember.
Or but is it just that there was Demolition Blast, and then there was a guy who claimed he was like an additional member of Demolition that people thought was Demolition Blast, but was actually just a guy pretending?
Yeah.
I think it was something more like that, right?
Yeah.
That guy who you would read
is he working a scam like he's like, oh, I was the hangman of the WWF.
Right. Your guy that would do your Big Daddy Bruno Beefcake type of articles. He would say he was like a third member of Demolition, so people would think he was Blast, but he wasn't Blast.
Yeah.
Blast was Billy Eady's actual
indie partner. Better you think he's Blast than you think he's Crush.
Right. Well, Blast was actually Billy Eady's tag team partner on the indies.
Now, I think what was funny here is the whole Memphis in this whole Japanese tournament deal they always would do. Or Lawler and Valiant eventually did go, but in 85. But Jeff Jarrett and Jerry Lawler did
some
not
of the guys.
Go.
Did Jarrett go to Wing, maybe?
Yeah. Jarrett went to
SWS. Well, wait, Jarrett went to SWS, though, but Lawler didn't.
Yeah, Jarrett was the SWS regular, but Jerry Lawler wasn't going to Japan.
I know Danny Davis and I think Brian Christopher were working Wing at that point, around that
season. Yeah, they had a deal with Wing. Yeah, Memphis guys are going over, because the Gilberts were, booking the talent, performing talent.
Who was it that, wanted to go to Wing or that didn't end up going to? Wasn't there some kind of conflict when there was someone who wanted to go to All Japan or that All Japan wanted and told them not to go to Wing? Through the Memphis deal. Who was it?
I can't remember.
What I'm talking about, though. There was someone who they were like, we're not going to bring in guys from the smaller promotions, so don't go to Wing. There was something like that. I remember reading something like that in The Observer, but I don't remember who it was.
I can't remember either. Now, on television this past Saturday, Nate the Rat, who was the heel manager at the time, tried to use a butane lighter and a blowtorch to throw fire at Jarrett. But he was thwarted, and Jarrett ended up throwing fire at Nate. Jarrett took a lot of time getting it done, but burned some of Nate's hair. Now, they announced the main event for November 25th was a turkey match, Thanksgiving time. We have Lawler, Spirit of America, Jarrett, and Dr. Tom going against Eric Emery, Tony Falk, Gravedigger, and Kamala. And when Falk came out and asked what a turkey match was, they poured syrup all over him and feathers over his head and said that the loser comes out with feathers like a turkey. So the old tar and feathering of Tony Falk.
But without the offensive parts.
Yeah, without the offensive parts. Now, as I was saying, there were several new gimmick wrestlers that have shown up. The Candyman, a babyface who gives candy to all the kids at ringside, is Reggie B. Fine, one of my all-time favorites, doing the gimmick the Brad Armstrong was supposed to do but never actually did.
He did do it. What are they talking about? What did he? What?
I guess Dave meant he didn't do it like this guy did it. He didn't go full bore with it like Reggie did, because Reggie did a lot more. You know, it was played up, I guess you could say.
Yeah, and I don't know if Brad actually ever gave out candy to the fans.
Brad never gave out candy. Exactly. Not that I remember. They had the Young Gun. It's a guy named Mike Mitchell, and he and Robert Fuller are USWA tag champions. Here's a nice little note. Also in is the Sandman, who is from Philadelphia and is a Joel Goodhart wrestler, and the Black Cat, JT Smith from Philadelphia, who most say is Goodhart's best local wrestler. All the newcomers seem to be getting pushes. And we have Larry Sharp trainee Jimmy Dijewski, who wore New Jersey Indies as Jimmy Atlas, is scheduled to start next week doing an Ultimate Warrior gimmick.
So, about Nathan Rad, has anyone ever seen Nate and Mike Sweetser in the same room?
Oh! If you want to see Nate the Rat, Jerry Lawler's heel run in 1990, Nate the Rat was one of Lawler's lackeys. So okay. You can go watch that.
Butler.
He was his butler. Nathaniel Whitlock. But go check those out and you see them. The key thing here, though, is Sandman JT Smith. Sandman at this time period had the surfer thing going on.
He would for at least 2.5 more years.
Yeah, I know. So he had that full surfer thing going on. And JT Smith, from if I remember right, he basically just had that black singlet on, looking like JT Smith. But it's just funny seeing that Sandman and JT Smith as Memphis regulars for a short time period.
When was Candido in?
Candido was in before this. He was in early 91.
Okay.
But yeah, that's one thing Memphis would do. They would work with Goodhart and Coraluzzo and bring those guys in.
Lot of guys did, but I mean, you'd hear a lot of stories of guys who would like leave right away or would specifically save money so they could go to Memphis and get experience without having to worry about the fact that they were either losing money or barely breaking even.
It seemed like the guys would come in for like a month. They'd get pushed huge, and then they get jobbed out right away, and they'd just be like poof, like little
right.
Just like
because vanish. they didn't realize that they would not be able to live.
Right, they're like fruit flies, basically, like kind of lifespan.
Right. I mean, the only ones who would stay would be the ones who knew. Okay, I'm going to maybe even lose money. I have to save up money before I go here to get experience.
Right, or the guys were just homesteading there for whatever reason.
And now we're going to close out with WCW, and they had the Clash of the Champions take place on November 19th in Savannah, Georgia, at the Civic Center. And we have the following matches. Big Josh beating Thomas Ridge in a lumberjack match.
How dare you?
I know. Bobby Eaton going over Firebreaker Chip. Then we have the whole Sting, Medusa, Luger angle. Then we have Tom Zink going over the Diamond Stud. Steve Austin retaining the TV title going over PNUs. Cactus Jack going over Van Hammer, which included the Van Hammer video. Then we had Ricky Steamboat and Dustin Rhodes winning the tag titles from Arn Anderson and Larry Zbyszko.
The Enforcers.
Then we had the video debut of Jushin Liger on television. And we had Brian Pillman beating Johnny Bedford for the light heavyweight title. Rick Rude beating Sting to win the U.S. title. Luger going over Rick Steiner to retain the WCW title. The card drew 6,922 fans. Fans turned away at the door. Crowd heat was excellent. I mean, it was a great show. But, of course, this show would be forever remembered for the whole Ricky Steamboat angle.
Ricky Steamboat.
He's just a man.
But, I mean, it was a big deal, Pete, because the Steamboat had just been WWF like the month before.
Yep.
And here he comes as Dustin Rhodes' tag team partner, and what a whole spectacle this whole deal was.
It was incredible. I mean, the second he comes out, and you kind of think, yeah, maybe, and then he takes the mask off, and the whole crowd just loses their shit because he was just in WWF. Now he's back. It's just like one of the greatest pops you'll ever hear.
And the way Capetta announces him too.
Yes.
He's just like, it's Ricky.
It's the Ricky Dragon, the Dragon Steamboat.
And I just love the whole, like, when he comes out in that dragon outfit, the head of which then became part of his entrance later on, just sitting on a stick by the entrance at center stage. That it's like, Shivani and Ross are talking about, well, I mean, you know, this could be a Japanese wrestler. And then I love how it's like, I think it's Shivani that says, you know, Jim, for all we know, there could be a masked wrestler under there.
Yeah.
And then just finally he's there in the old, you know, WCW Ricky Steamboat outfit, and one of the greatest performances of Arn Anderson and Larry Zbyszko's career. Just their reaction. Selling.
Yeah, Arn's Casper, a ghost face.
He's like, not Ricky Steamboat, and then they're just, yeah, like, and then Zbyszko's calming him down. He's just a man.
Just a man.
This is probably, if not top five, still one of the very best matches in the history of TBS.
Oh, definitely. And maybe the second best clash match. Well, third best clash match ever.
What would you put ahead of it?
Probably Sting, Flair, and Flair Funk.
You would not put Flair Steamboat ahead of it.
And Flair Steamboat. That's right. Maybe the fourth best then.
My gut would say maybe to actually put Sting, Flair behind it.
Yeah, but there's a whole lot more good. That
well,
went
it's
on with
it's
that.
Which is the if you're just gonna say which is the better like worked match, it's this.
Well, I go with total package.
Yeah, as
match.
A moment, I mean that's different. That's it's a whole. It's kind of its own thing. Yeah.
Yeah.
But this is just it's a perfect tag team match. I mean, this is really the moment that you can kind of tell how good Dustin Rhodes is, but he didn't really get enough credit for a long time. Steamboat is just out of this world. Like, you can tell how thrilled he is to be Ricky Steamboat again.
Yeah.
And, like, I even talked to, like, when I interviewed him, and I think we used some of this for, like, an article in Fighting Spirit a few months ago. Like, he's talking about how he don't think about it, but this is actually the first time he ever worked with Arn.
That's right.
Because yeah. Arn started in Crockett, like, literally right after Steamboat left, within, like, a month or two. And, like, Steamboat had his way of, like, making sure that heels would let him call stuff. And, like, Arn ended up saying, like, after the match, like, I don't usually let babyfaces call stuff, but I did for you, and blah, 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 because, you know, that just because of how good he was, that Steamboat, like, had his own way of, like, calling spots in a way that the heels would appreciate and that heels would let him do because he always made sure that, you know, it'd be like, it wasn't just for him to look good, he would throw in so they'd cut him off and all that, and... Just his selling here in this match. I mean, even, you know, it's Ricky Steamboat.
State of the art.
It's Ricky Steamboat, but this is still one of his greatest performances. And I have to throw in our friend Tom Kay. He's a review of this match. I remember because he singles out, and I remember I showed this to Tom when I interviewed Steamboat, and I talked to him about this type of stuff. Like, Steamboat keeps doing this thing where, like, he does it in other matches, but it's really pronounced here where he starts just, like, making little gestures with his fingers. And I just, the Tom line, because this is the quintessential Tom line, because he's talking about, like, he's like, I hate people who write creepy reviews of women's matches and stuff, but I'll just embrace the creepy here. And he said, and I quote, I guess I paraphrase, you watch this match and you really wish that Ricky Steamboat was digitally stimulating your prostate. I'm just going to let that go to see how long it takes before he stops.
Tom, that's definitely a Tom line.
Now you know where Steamboat got the finger stuff from?
Where?
Jay Youngblood.
Okay, that makes sense. I remember seeing Jay do that. Yeah, that makes sense now.
So like he got a lot of stuff like that from Jay, and that makes me wish we had more Jay Youngblood too. That
oh yeah, when he was actually good. Yeah,
I mean because Steamboat speaks with him with such reverence.
He was still alive.
Yeah, he died so young.
I mean, even when he was, like, right at the end, though, he was still having really good matches, too. Like, that one match with him and his brother against Koloff and Kernodle. You know the one,
yeah.
Right? The one that home video?
Oh, yeah.
One? Yeah. But this is just a great, great match. Probably, I mean, when they did that Greatest Clash Matches countdown on the second all-nighter, this was, I think, it was in the top five, right?
Yes.
I don't remember how high. I want to say it was maybe, like... It was behind the two, you know, it was behind the two famous long flyer matches, but I think it might have even been, it might have been as high as number three, right? If yeah, I look it up right now, because they were in order, if I looked right now what was on that show, I would be able to tell.
All right, well, you can look, while you look that up, real quick, Pete, talking about the Sting, Luger, Medusa, Rude deal on this show. And I love Dave has some great lines talking about this whole deal, like when Lex worked over the wrong leg. And Dave said, well, he should be forgiven. All that Lucha Libre experience made Lex inadvertently grab the right leg. And then you had Parts Unknown Medical Center where Sting went to in Savannah.
At least he wasn't walking back to the arena.
Yeah, and Sting hijacking the ambulance just in the nick of time.
No thanks to Bobby Eaton, though.
Bobby Eaton told him to go to the wrong door. But I love this whole angle. I mean, it was great, Pete. It was really great.
It's just the whole buildup with him getting the conga line of different boxes from people week after week.
Yeah. Here's Abdullah. Here's Cactus.
It's Abdullah. It's Cactus. Huzzah!
Yeah, and then here comes Luger as the final prize.
The final boss.
But as you mentioned that earlier, it's about Sherry and Warrior, Medusa did the same deal with Sting.
Yes.
And then Sting looked like he was about to explode there for a minute. And he did his
Well, also Sting this is one of those great stupid Sting moments of him being an idiot. Because Medusa had already been on TV as a heel.
Yeah.
Yeah, right.
But she's rubbing on his thighs. And Sting looked there and said, you want to do this? Now, I love that line, too. You want to do this? That's great stuff. And, yeah, it definitely got over the – yes, right. It got over the future of the Dangerous Alliance. And also, this showed the whole – Luger and the Luger-Steiner deal, that was just like a weird way they were going with the world title.
They just needed something for Rick to do, and they needed something for Luger to do. So
just basically feeding Rick to Luger from this one.
Yeah, it felt like the third most important thing on the show behind the U.S. title and the tag titles. It was just a weird deal to go off with.
Okay, but it looks like the tag title match from the show was number five.
That's where I would have had it ranked four.
Although, what's ahead of it though? Because you got it's Sting Flair is number one.
I bet you Flair win the versus Midnight Express was ranked ahead of it, wasn't it?
No, Flair Funk is number two.
Okay.
Then number three is Sting and Dusty versus Arn and Tully.
That's weird.
And then four was Flair Steamboat. Clash. And then five was the tag match from this show. You know what? I'm trying to remember if they did this out of order. Isn't there a match missing?
No, they didn't.
It wasn't in order, right? But is there? Because there's a match I'm trying to remember that was on there. What was in the? I feel like there's a match missing, and I'm trying to remember what it was in this match list I'm looking at.
But anyway, interesting backstage development regarding Ricky Steamboat took place at the show. Apparently, the week before the show, WCW contacted WWF and told them of their intention to use Steamboat at the Clash and requested that the WWF believe they had any legal claim to Steamboat to please contact them by that Friday. Well, Steamboat has signed a two-year contract with Titan Sports, which expired around January 4th, 1993. Although one could certainly make the case that being fired should nullify the contract, Steamboat's attorneys could claim that Titan had violated the contract in two places and it should be voided. Anyway, less than an hour before showtime, Titan sent a fax to WCW office in Atlanta, where everyone of importance was already in Savannah for the Clash, claiming they had legal rights to Steamboat. The word did reach the building before the show, and Kit Fry, WCW legal counsel, met with Jim Herb and Jim Crockett, and the decision was made to use Steamboat. But Dave's not sure the details of the contract, although he believes he'll be working 100 dates, schedule similar to Big Van Vader. Now, in Matt Watch, Steve Beverly reported that as of 3 days before the Clash, Steamboat's new contract with WCW was set to expire on June 30th, 1992. To that, Beverly said that certainly Rick has to wonder what his status will be when Barry Windham and Ron Simmons return to full health. The following week, Beverly wrote that Steamboat's deal was not finalized until the afternoon of the Clash, but we're told money was not the issue like it was when his July 1989 renewal talks failed. So, yeah. So Steamboat was going to work a limited schedule originally, and boy, did that change. He worked all the house shows, basically he could work, but he was so important to that.
He probably loved it. He probably loved it, just getting back into the swing of things with them.
Yeah, and that was like a mini boom period for WCW. You know, when he came aboard with Rude getting hot and the Dangerous Alliance.
Well, because WCW, the previous 4 months had been really bad.
Oh, yeah. God. And talking about, you know, that, the ratings. The Clash rating drew a 4.3, which translated into 2,406,000 homes, which is the best rating since the Black Scorpion Clash a year ago.
Which was the, I believe, the most watched special in the history of pro wrestling.
Yeah. Interesting enough, unlike almost every previous Clash, the rating didn't peak during the main event. The audience peaked with the Steamboat Tag Match, which drew a 4.7 rating, or 2,706,000 homes. Then fell off significantly during the Brian Pillman-Johnny B. Badd match for some reason. And it came back to a 4.7 for Rude Sting, before dropping to a 4.5 for Luger Steiner.
Now, one thing I want to add, though, with that Clash, I believe this is the first appearance of the words nearby medical facility.
Yes. Like I said, parts unknown medical center.
Well, but and I mean, that, the
reason Eric Bischoff was like the Bernard Shaw of the scene at the time. He was reporting, you know, like he was in Iraq or something.
you're a roving reporter.
Eric Bischoff.
Well, people think of it as a WWF line, though.
Yeah, when North America and all the ships at sea.
This is the this is the first time I ever remember hearing it, though, so I'm thinking it's probably more of a Jim Ross thing. And it became a WWF thing via Jim Ross.
Yeah. Yeah, it could be. Yeah.
But yes, Bischoff's performance during this is special.
Yes, he's very, very good in this role.
The Don Lemon of professional wrestling.
Yeah. Now, on the November 23rd episode of World Championship Wrestling, which was taped the next night at Center Stage after the Clash on November 20th, Paulie Dangerously officially formed the Dangerous Alliance, where Bobby Eaton, you know, the whole deal where they revealed that Bobby Eaton told Sting to go to the wrong door on purpose, and then Steve Austin joined the group. And this was a big deal, man, because the Dangerous Alliance was the first big heel faction since the Horsemen. And they gave off a vibe, I thought, Pete, that was way different than the Horsemen, as they were more of a band of thugs than the Horsemen.
They were like a heel supergroup, basically.
Yeah, they were. They were like a heel version of Asia.
Yeah.
The band.
Nice.
But yeah, I mean, they were so awesome. Everybody played off each other so well in that deal, too.
I'm just picturing Rude belting out Heat of the Moment now for some reason.
And now we're here in 1992.
perfect.
Yeah, but they could all interchange with each other so well. Rude could team with Zabisco. Arn could team with Austin. Then you had the six-mans. And just great television this era with the Dangerous Alliance and all the WCW babyfaces that could also interchange with each other so well.
And just they could all go. That whole group could go collectively.
Yeah, they all had something. It's one of the best rosters of the modern era wrestling. If you look at all the guys that were on that roster, head to toe.
But even in the Alliance.
Especially batting average wise, like you might have more quantity on like Nitro era WCW, but like in terms of the percentage of guys who were great workers.
The slugging percentage, maybe?
Yeah.
Yeah, but you look at guys like the Young Pistols working mid card. You got
Terry Taylor.
Matt Bourne, it's Big Josh, Terry Taylor, Ricky Morton, Thomas Rich. I mean,
Richard Armstrong.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, Brad Armstrong's there. I mean, just a lot of guys that Cat Foley. I mean, just a lot of guys that were. Vader was starting to get, you know, on the Mr. Hughes, although he wasn't a great worker, but he was effective.
Slater
wasn't there. They had then left as Slater came back in 92.
Okay. Okay, gotcha.
Slater
okay,
and Greg Valentine was there, you know, that same time period.
Right.
Later on in the run. But yeah, I mean, it's just a loaded roster.
And Mr. Hughes, not a great wrestler, but...
Tremendous trainer.
Yeah, I was going to say, from the Billy Gunn school of not great workers who are great trainers.
He projected menace really well.
Yeah, Mr. Hughes was great in that role. I mean, he was really great as that security type, that higher goon. He could hit you with that stack of doorknobs, and you believed it. Hire goons. But what wasn't loaded, though, was the manager circuit, as they basically wanted Paul Lee to be the manager. So and Medusa. So in one day after the Clash, Jeannie Clark was told her services were no longer needed, since Austin joined the Dangerous Alliance. Alexandra York and Teddy Long were also told that they were going to be phased out. But Long's chances improved as the week went on, as it looked like he would stay much longer than York would. Also, there's talk that Harley Race will only be used as a manager on special occasion, which, in fact, pissed off Lex Luger so much that on the day after this week, on the 24th, he quit for 2 hours, and they eventually talked him to come back. So, yeah, I mean, I can understand, you know, they want to make Paul Lee the singular manager, but it's always good to have that secondary manager around, I thought. And Race, right, eventually, I mean, he became that, managing Vader and Hughes and
Super Invader.
Super Invader. He was like, yeah, he would manage the big guys while Paul managed the work rate guys.
Yeah.
So it was like old WWF, where each guy had their, like, their niche guys, their niche
show. Yeah, Race was Blassie, and Paul was the Wizard. Coincidentally enough, I mean, Graham was one of Paul's heroes.
So it was there was no, was there an Albano?
There was,
no, was Humperdinck still there?
No, he wasn't there. That'd been a good choice though. But
yeah, yeah.
No Albano. But,
yeah, and DDP, what was DDP doing?
DDP was actually starting to wrestle at this time. Air Bischoff.
Oh. Allegedly.
Allegedly, that's right. Now, here's an interesting story.
By Chris, not me.
I totally zoned out about, I totally forgot about this, that the great Muda, who was supposed to come in after the Tokyo Dome and didn't, was apparently going to be Rose's secret partner for the Clash in the event that Steamboat wasn't able to work the show.
So I guess a little bit of an inside reference when they talk about, oh, maybe that's a Japanese wrestler with the dragon head.
Was he actually in the building for this in case it happened?
I don't know if he was in the, I don't know. He was in Japan.
Okay. Oh yeah. Right. Cause he was a Corkin, right.
Yeah. So it was in that time period, but yeah, I mean, and the dragon head was kind of like Muda's old headgear in a way.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah.
So, I mean, let's throw the hypothetical up. All right. What if Steamboat couldn't come in and it was Muda? How do you think that changes the whole deal?
Well, he's not full time. So either they lose or they switch the titles back quick, I think.
Yeah, but it's just like it takes away from the specialness, I think, of the whole deal.
It would be Muda's face turn, though.
Yeah, but it's not Steamboat. Steamboat had a connection.
No, I agree. But, I mean, I think Muda coming back as a babyface would be a relatively big deal.
Muda was so off the charts great back at that point that he would have been a face just for his work if they weren't pushing him over the top doing heel shit. Because he was getting over just on his work when he came in like 89, right?
Right. And then, and then finally, when they did bring him in as a baby face, it was just uneventful.
Yeah.
Yeah. Exactly.
He was just coming out and just doing matches like with the Brad Armstrong match.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, for as much as that company wanted to turn him, that finally when he was a baby face, it just happened. They really should have found something they could have done.
Exactly. Now, here's the interesting stuff. All right. Most people seem to be crediting a lot of the positive changes in the company to the greater influence of Jim Crockett. Crockett has been saying things that make sense for the better part of the past 3 years, but nobody's been listening. And over the past few weeks, they have been. In particular, Crockett's been pushing for putting more heat on the heels since the company has lacked heels with heat. Crockett is in more of a power position, and lots of the changes, which is more emphasis on those with wrestling ability, the devaluation of pushes for guys like Van Hammer, Marcus Alexander Bagwell, and El Gigante have had something to do with him, but Jim Herd is still the man in charge. Yeah, you know, Kid Fry always gets the praise for that 1992 stuff, but it was Jim Crockett that set the table for all that. You know, interesting.
Yeah, and it's so weird, too, because it's such a what-if, because the family was supposed to stay in charge of the company. Everyone forgets that.
Yeah. And Jimmy was always around, but like I said, like Dave said, nobody really listened to anything he was saying that much.
But I mean,
he was just like a silent partner. But it went on by his making. He was actually, they were just tuning him out.
I'm not saying he had a great batting average or anything, but every time they did listen to him or give him power, it usually had fairly good results.
He had a good on base percentage.
Yeah,
exactly.
So what you're saying? You're saying he's the best wrestling promoter in terms of saber metrics.
Whip WHIP, right?
Yeah. His Strike Us versus
wait, that would be a Zach saber metrics.
That's right. Yeah. there was a lot of manipulation going on in WCW at the time.
Oh, really?
Not finger manipulation like Zack Sabre Jr., but here's some interesting stuff. The Torch was reporting rumors, such as Jerry Jarrett was linked to this promotion for like 4 years, being brought in as one of the bookers, and the Honky Tonk Man Ultimate Warrior combination coming in during January.
That way, were they being linked together?
No, they were coming in. And I didn't put this in the notes or anything, but Wade openly said that Luger and Ultimate Warrior would have been the main event for Super Brawl if they could have brought him in.
Could you imagine that version of Luger wrestling whatever the Ultimate Warrior would have looked like in that version of WCW?
I tell you what, I can only imagine what the steroid test would have been before the match. It would have been off the charts.
You're like a pinball machine.
Because Luger had really got jacked up getting ready for his WBF run.
He was so jacked up that Kip Fry apologized to the newsletters.
Yes.
That is a thing that actually happened.
He was just insanely jacked up. And then, another thing that I didn't put in the notes either that I thought was interesting, thinking about it, is the Super Bowl II location was originally supposed to be the Taj Mahal in Atlantic City, not Milwaukee.
It's been done.
Yeah, if you wonder why the Mecca Milwaukee was a weird venue choice for that show, that's why. It wasn't the original choice. The Taj Mahal in Last City was. That would have been interesting to see them try to run a casino.
Well, the Trump Taj Mahal is not an actual building, though. I mean, it's Boardwalk Hall. They just name it after whoever's
sponsoring it.
Yeah, whoever sponsors the show.
Yeah, you're right. All the big boxing matches in Last City have in Boardwalk Hall. So, yeah.
So, WrestleMania, people don't know that. WrestleMania 4 and 5, that's Boardwalk Hall.
Yeah, exactly. It's not at the Trump Plaza.
Yeah.
Now, it was a great story, and I wish I could have seen this. On November 17th in Greensboro at the Coliseum, which drew 750 fans.
Oh.
How the mighty have fallen.
Exactly. Well, that market had been burnt out. Sting beat Cactus Jack in a steel cage match that was rated at 3 stars. But the story was what happened during the match, as apparently a rib thought up by Sting occurred. Jack came to the ring with a towel, and during the match he went for the towel, where he pulled out a foreign object from the towel, which was a squeegee.
Dun, dun, dun.
When Sting saw it, he sold it like it was a shotgun, and acted totally panicked, trying to escape from the cage. Jack ended up using it on Sting, who sold the blows huge. Sting used it on Jack as well, and ended up tossing it to the crowd. It should be noted that our friends at Front Row Section D, earlier in the show, which probably was Bruce Mitchell, had brought out several cardboard cutouts of squeegees, which nearly sent Mike Graham and Brian Pillman into stitches. Now, Bix, real quick, tell the squeegee story.
So, Sid, who had just started with the WWF, was in a bar with Mike Graham and Brian Pillman, who were in WCW, bragging about how much money he was making and talking about how they were little guys and would never make any money.
Where have we heard this story before? How much money Sid was making.
And I guess it was Pillman challenged him to a fight. Now, so Sid goes to his car, comes back to bring a weapon. Keep in mind, we're talking about Sid, much bigger than Brian Pillman. The weapon being a squeegee. Now, to defend Sid, and that sounds weird, but I would think a squeegee would hurt. It's a heavy-handled item.
It's also probably really, really stinky. There's a lot of stuff in there. You don't want to get get something in your eyes. Get some Windex in your eyes. That could be a problem.
But
exactly.
So I always thought, but it's. I think it's just the idea that the word squeegee is funny, which of course it is. So of course, but and then Mike Graham just kind of like calmly took it from him. Like, yeah, you're not going to do that.
And Mike Graham.
I just want to see Sting showing his ass for this thing, like as the face, stooging for the squeegee.
I know, right? This just would have been phenomenal to see Sting in a rib like this on a show. And Mike Graham, not to anyone, even though he's like in his 40s, he's still Mike Graham. He's still a tough ass joker. You know, somebody you definitely would not want to mess with. Yeah, that's a fun little story there, which, the squeegee story was one of those go-to stories in the newsletter era. And it's, again, Sid being the complete goof.
Sid Udy.
Sid Udy being a complete goofball. And our final note of the show, which this is something that Bix added to the notes. Jim Ross said on his radio show on November 17th on WSB 750 Atlanta, the blowtorch of the South, that bookings, that's what it's called, that bookings for the upcoming Bruise Cruise were 85% female up to that point. Woo, buddy! You know that those wrestlers definitely, you know, had their fun on that boat. Believe me. There needs to be like a oral
history of the Bruise
Cruise. Oral history of the Bruise Cruise. Where really we get an oral history of the Bruise Cruise.
A 30 for 30.
I mean, God, I can't believe. And how long did the Bruise Cruise last?
Oh, God. Because it seemed like one of those things they wouldn't always advertise, but it would still happen.
Yeah.
Like, it probably was this the first year or the second year?
Had that been the first.
So it seemed like it went on through at least 94 or 95, right?
Maybe. Yeah.
But they didn't really promote it heavily. Like, wasn't there, like, a late-era Bruise Cruise where it's, like, just, like, Alex Wright and the State Patrol or something?
Yeah. Well, I'm sure Alex Wright slayed on that boat. But, I mean, really, Pete, who do you think out of the wrestlers probably got the most?
Oh, I know who it was. Zeman. It was Zeman. I'm sure it was Zeman.
Bagwell. Sure
there's a lot of Zeman going back and forth.
Bagwell.
Why do you think I said Zeman?
Yeah.
Who are your blowjob babies there? I'm trying to think who else they would have been. Pillman?
Well, we
Pillman.
Zang.
Armstrong.
No Johnny Gunn yet.
He's coming, though. No pun intended. Dustin, maybe?
Yeah, Dustin Wyndham, sort of.
Yeah, Barry Wyndham's still youngish.
I'm sure Sting. There were some lovely rich South African women on that tour.
Sting, I'm pretty sure, partake of some of the action.
You gotta think the Steiners. I mean, the Steiner. You got two. The Steiners got two different looks. I mean, Rick's got the bear type thing going for him. I don't know.
Yeah.
The big burly, you know, the big burly lumberjack kind of guy. Big Josh.
Yeah, it was Matt Bourne. Although.
I hope they knew better than to allow Matt Bourne on an 85% female fan boat trip in the middle of the ocean.
Warning.
Yeah, don't help him take his bags to his room.
Scott Steiner, I can imagine, definitely would have been an aggressive guy to...
Terry Taylor,
yeah. Definitely what a tailor-made man's all about. Oh, Rude.
Rude.
Austin.
Yeah.
Austin.
Austin. Austin had that long blonde hair, yeah.
Arn, showing off his cat bat skills.
Now, Arn is a bear, and he definitely had, you know, hey, he's built up. We know that. So,
I mean, even Zabisco was pretty ripped at that point in his career.
Yeah. I'm just there's definitely got to be some stories from that. Somebody needs to tell some stories.
Yeah, I imagine like Arn's talking to Flair about this, and Flair's just starting to wonder if he made the right decision.
Yeah. Oh, Steve Armstrong and Tracy Smothers was around. We forgot about them.
Yeah.
And Ricky Morton, you know, he's still there. He could have got some of those 80s, retreads on there.
Look at
Tommy Rich with all those girls that grew up watching him in Atlanta.
I know, right? God, this is amazing.
Reliving glory days. Think about that. Come on.
Yeah, totally.
Oh my God, this is a. Can you? It's just God. They get
the
paid
mind
to do
boggles.
This.
Yeah. The Tommy Rich story that Mike Neimark tells about the dipping of his
the hydrogen peroxide.
Yeah, hydrogen.
Which he said, which I believe he said looked like what, like a bad cheese pizza.
On that note. On that note, we're going to end the show here.
Go allegedly.
Plug, Pete, you have anything to plug?
Just go to the website, deathvalleydriver.com. Phil has gone and tweaked things up a little bit, trying to refresh the site. Just come to the message board. Come on down. We may even sign you up. We may even get the membership working again at some point. So come on down. Go for it.
Deathvalleydriver.com. Are the road reports back up yet, or did someone have to use Wayback Machine for those?
They're coming back in drips and drabs. I saw the some of the earlier ECWA. I saw that some of the Super 8 reports are coming back up. I'm going to start, you know, we have to start. I have the world's worst ADD, but I'm going to start doing contributing again to the Death Valley. I mean, we're still doing the drivers on a semi-regular basis. We just cut the new one out, trying to keep more coming forward.
Yeah, and for those of you that haven't done it, go to archive.org, put deathvalleydriver.com in, and read those old road reports. Because whether it's Phil and Tom or Pete and Rev Ray and the groups like that.
Or all of the above at some shows.
Or all of them together, like Super 8s or whatever. Just fantastic stuff. I mean, it definitely changed me as a fan in a lot of ways. Oh, yeah. I can't talk about that site well enough, man. How much we, I mean, that site was just so awesome. Influential of the time period.
Was?
It kind of still is. It's not glory days level.
I know.
In the 500 era, when the 500 was coming out, you know, on a regular basis, I mean, that was a huge deal. It was a big time deal. I mean, that you could argue
we would have so much fun putting that together and then putting out the quote sheets of everyone, and where you have to see what people were saying about who, and you had to guess who the quotes were about.
So
yeah. Well, I think that site pretty much made a lot of the Northeastern Indy guys and IWM Mid-South in a lot of ways.
APW.
I mean, yeah, it was so influential on the Indy
Omega.
Scene. Omega, definitely. It doesn't get talked about nearly enough. And I know I've had requests from people to do a DVDVR Exile show. So maybe in 2016 that may come.
Hell, I mean, look at the guys who either came into the chat or posted on the board or just different things. And
yeah, get the whole crew. Do a round table. Bring the whole crew out.
Christopher Daniels coming to the board specifically to thank the guys for ranking him number 19 in the 500.
Dutch lurking on the board, apparently, and even posting a little bit.
I don't remember that.
CM Punk.
He was apparently there. He posted a little bit, and people put two and two together, and they decided this was Dutch. Dutch Mantel is actually there.
CM Punk, Colt Cabana, Chris Hero, Chris Hamrick, all in the Mike Quackenbush.
I think Loki briefly at one time.
All were in the chat room, you know.
Didn't Loki show up at the board like very briefly at one point?
Yes, Loki was there for a small bit. I mean, it was just a very powerful
board. A lot of guys still lurk too.
Brian Danielson, who never posted but was always known lurker.
Dave Meltzer lurks there. I mean, there's a lot of people that lurks there. So Deathvalley Driver, definitely a key part of wrestling history in the last 15, 20 years. And it's still going, so go check it out, folks.
Fat Spanish Waiter's got a lot of fans.
We're still kicking.
Exactly. He stepped all over that joke. God.
And the Deathvalley Driver is the only place that you will see the true Lucha Report.
With the posters, yes.
With all the posters.
19 million posters a week.
And you don't know what Chris goes through to find that. Those are some bad things happen when he goes.
Oh, I can imagine. I see what goes in there.
The latest now is that people are posting virus video links to all a bunch of heads that were chopped off by El Chapo's crew, all lined up together along this brick wall.
What is this, a llama?
Yeah, well, it's better than bestiality and child porn. So I'd rather look at severed heads than look at that. Looking at a dog fucking some woman. So anyway, on that note, Bix. What kind of
plug? That note.
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah. Right.
Really?
That's quite the toss.
Bix, what are you plugging besides bestiality?
Oh God damn it! I don't
top
even.
That.
I'm not sure I can or want to.
Bronco Bix at bestiality.com. If that's even a site.
I really hope it's not.
Fix it, Goatse.
Oh, God.
Goatse. Goatse.cx. Coupon code Bix.
Oh, Jesus. What have I done?
Oh, God. People know at this point, don't they? They know not to go there. Does the original still exist? I'm not sure.
I don't think it exists.
I don't think the original does. I think you have to try to find it now, right? Like if someone, I don't think anyone could send you to that URL at least. To that specific URL.
Maybe if you searched it through Google Image, it might be in there with your safe search off.
Or archive.
Archive maybe, yeah. But go ahead, Bix.
I'll let Pete go first. He's like, no, already. I'll let Chris go. I'll let Chris go first.
Son,
me go first. I close. I close the show out.
Not you this guys. Week.
I am. Go ahead.
I don't know. Okay. Figure Four Weekly this week. I did a thing. Kind of writing up the Jersey All Pro show from last week.
Great.
Mainly
show.
The primarily
great
the Rey Mysterio Loki match. Which, you know, Pete was there. I know Chris has seen it since, which hopefully it does get officially released soon. Both just so people can see that Rey Mysterio Loki match, and also just to, because it would, I would think, help Frank's family if they sold it and had the DVD out. I know it was shot. Our good friend MLJ was doing commentary with the former Corvus Fear, so that hopefully that comes out soon. But that was really good, so I kind of wrote about that and compared it to the other Mysterio Dream matches so far, and talked about Loki a bit and just how good Loki is. So check that out. Last couple days on SE Scoops, I guess now a few days ago when this goes up, been covering the police report that came out in the Hogan sex tape case and have some other stuff I need to go through there. Just probably maybe even some more Hogan-related stuff in Figure Four this week, because there's a lot that I had to put on the back burner because of that. I believe the new Fighting Spirit is out this week with my Terry Funk article, so there's that. And I guess that's it for now. Yeah. So, Chris, the Georgia homeboy, what do you have to plug?
Well, we have the latest episode of Exile on Bad Street, which may or may not be out before this show drops. And I hope it is out, because it's awesome, because it's the Nick Botwinkle tribute show with our buddy Dylan Hales and Kevin Cerruti, K-Hawk. From Pro Wrestling Only, and the AWA historian du jour. He is really good on this show. We really talk about a lot of the stuff that been about Botwinkle's career. Kind of a good companion piece to Dave's great, great bio on Bach, a bit on Bach in The Observer. And and touching on stuff that he didn't mention, including a Gordon Solie angle, Gordon Solie angle that nobody talks about. From 1978, mainly because it wasn't on video. So,
interesting.
Yeah, definitely look out for that. Of course, Between the Sheets every week. And actually, we can announce the next show.
Yes, we
as
can.
The next show we're going to do, we'll be covering November 24th through, what, November 30th?
Yes.
Oh, that's right. November 30th.
Yes, you add 6 days to get the set because...
I know. But I was trying to remember, 31, there's no 31st day in November. The November 30th, 1995, which is the end of Smoky Mountain Wrestling. And our guest on that show will be the Hangman, Tim Noel, from Wrestling Power and stuff like that. He was there at those shows, so he has a live perspective from that era, and it's a good companion piece because it's an Exile on Bad Street coming out either that week or around that time period, featuring Dylan Hales again, who's basically Dylan's become my de facto co-host on that show, and good old Will from Texas, as we're going to talk about the history of Smoky Mountain Wrestling and celebrating the 20th anniversary of its demise. But we're going to be definitely more positive on that show, talk about all the greatness that happened in that promotion over its 4-year existence. So a lot of Smoky Mountain talk coming up over the next week, so be on the lookout for that.
What you're not going to be positive about Butch Cassidy next week?
Oh, but the Wolfman.
Wolfman breaking his posterior giblet.
Yeah, the Bruiser Bedlam. You're talking about how great of a guy he was. Cowabunga, the Ninja Turtle. I mean, yeah, there's going to be a lot of stuff going on. We may even talk about Casey O'Connor. Who knows? But
There's a letter. I believe there's either. Oh, I think there's a Clash review from Casey O'Connor on the Torch covering this Clash.
Again, hey, we can't have a Between the Sheets without Casey O'Connor mentioned. And Bam Bam Bigelow was mentioned on this show, too.
And the Headhunters.
And Headhunters and Arsenio and
no one went to jail, but we had a lawsuit.
Yeah, we're hitting all of our. If you have a drinking game for BTS, I mean, we're hitting it tonight, folks.
Yeah, but allegedly is the new one.
Yeah, allegedly is the new one. Thank Pete for being our guest tonight, and definitely had
a pleasure. I loved it.
In the future,
thanks for having me.
Exactly. And Bix, of course, always a pleasure to have you with me by my side. And yeah, we'll be back soon. Oh, can't forget also Survivor Series reaction show.
That, up when this goes up. That'll be up already.
It'll be up the same time period as this show goes up. So be on the lookout for that, because it could be a very interesting show in more ways than one. So on that note, we'll see y'all next week. So for Pete and for Bix, for Chris, saying so long from the Peach State of Georgia.
Trust me. 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 Trust me.